I got you only to find that the teacher wasn't here. So clearly, in terms of age, you've surpassed my expectations. welcome, everybody, to this session. We have quite a few presentations that we are going to get from the department today. So we've got the department working overtime, as you can see, which is the way we like it, because we're sadistic, but we like to give the impression that we're hardworking, or that you are hardworking. Let me just begin firstly with a few household issues. Firstly, I think let me put off my phone. Please, those of you who have your phone, take the opportunity to also do that. Okay, let me just begin by thanking members who participated in the workshop, the away workshop that we had. I personally thought it was very useful, and I hope each of you derived some benefit from it. We will, of course, try and build on some of those issues as we go through as and when we have some time. Those of you who are not part of the workshop, I don't know, do we have some notes? Let me just check. Llewellyn will check for you if there are some notes, but it probably won't make too much of sense to people who are not there at all. But for what it's worth, I think good idea. There's also a book that you can get a reference from Llewellyn on, which is very, very useful, and it's an easy read, but it's actually quite groundbreaking in many respects. So you'll find that what you do is you get to a point where you read it over and over again, which is not something I usually like to do, but kind of book that lends itself to that kind of thing. Okay, so that's that. The other issue that I just want us to speak to, Llewellyn's going to give us the dates for the public hearings, but they are imminent. When I say the public hearings, I mean both the consideration of the written submissions, of which we have got about 270-odd written submissions, I kid you not, and pretty substantive ones at that. So what have they been distributed? Okay, so members apparently have these in hard copy or? In hard copy. Oh, so you all know your offices are also full of papers. So what I want to suggest is that members start and begin this week, begin to read those submissions. as we discussed previously, the public hearings will be held in phases. Because we are unable to schedule sort of a whole week of hearings, we've had to break it up into about three different sessions. The first part of it will be taking oral submissions from those people who have given us written submissions, but whose submissions we thought, myself, Llewellyn, Mr. Bundy, and Mr. Mahadu, thought would need some more interrogation, discussion, and debate and clarification. So in other words, where the portfolio committee will actually benefit from engaging these individuals to understand exactly what their submissions are and what their positions are on certain things. Of course, there are other submissions. As I said, we've got some pretty comprehensive submissions, some of which are very good, which are very clear, and that don't need substantiation. And for that reason, we're not calling those people to the oral hearings, because their inputs are so clear and succinct and so on. So we will have 4 days of oral engagements and perhaps even 6 days, depending on how we go. Once we've done the oral hearing stage, we will then proceed to consider every single submission and draw out from every single submission the key issue as a portfolio committee. And that process will probably take a good few sessions. So we'll try and have a meeting that sits all day so that we get through the bulk of those submissions. But if we can't, we might have to stagger it over 2 or 3 different meetings. But every single submission, even if it is just a one-liner that says, you know, the school that my child goes to is great, that will be considered, okay? And then, of course, we have to consolidate our views in a report with recommendations which will be submitted to the department. What I have done, because of the nature of some of these submissions, they have not been, you know, we called for submissions on the issue of quality and access in particular. But you'll find that there are other issues that people raise simply because these are public hearings. People feel that they can vet and just, you know, give us whatever. And not that those issues are not pertinent. So what I've done is I have asked the DG to ensure that we have somebody here from the department during the public hearings, which will basically mean that the department will also be engaging us during the public hearing. So if somebody raises something and they know that there's a development on that particular issue, we then have up-to-the-minute information during our public hearing. In addition to which, the department then is placed in a position where certain recommendations, even before we submit our report, can be taken up through the various units in the department if they are, in fact, very good recommendations and the department feels that that they are useful to them and so on. So that gives us a good kind of hybrid system where the department is not working in a silo and we as Parliament are not saying we're going to oversee the department in a silo, and that there's some kind of pollination, so to speak, of ideas. So that's really how we propose to go forward. What that means for members, really, is that basically it means that you must start reading those submissions. We are unable to start with submission 1, 2, and 3 for the simple reason that logistically sometimes people are not available on the first day. They may be available only the following week. So you'll find that we move between submissions. What we will endeavor to do, though, is we will try and give you a list of those organizations who have agreed to come on a particular day a few days ahead of time, so that you know which submissions we're going to be dealing with on that day. But it's really worthwhile, I think, for all of you to begin just reading some of these submissions. They are pretty long, and it is pretty time-consuming, but I think they're very, very valuable. On the whole, I must say, the quality of submissions has been extremely good, and I'm particularly pleased with that. So I don't know if there are any questions beyond the issue that Mr. Brown is going to address, which is when we're starting with it, so that you can diarize that. Let me just hand over to Mr. Brown so that he can give us a sense of the date. Please diarize these dates, and we can then engage with you on any questions you may have outside of that information.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Just to explain, there are two processes, especially with the applications and for 40 hearings that we've applied for. It's the one process is where we have received the okay from the Chief Whip's office, the House Chairperson, for the broad program, for the dates for our hearings. But what happens is we still have to apply, because there are days we will sit in a full day where we'll be going over into the plenary time. And on those days, although it doesn't affect our cluster, we still have to apply to the chief of office to meet during the plenary periods. We originally had for next week, the 12th and 13th, which was approved by the House Chairperson. Subsequent to that, on the 13th, they have now had a President's reply, if I'm not mistaken, on the 13th. So we'll only have the 12th for next week. That's a Wednesday. That'll be our first slot or batch of hearings. Will be on Wednesday the 12th. That'll be a full day. We're just waiting for the Chief Whip's approval. We shouldn't have any problems because the EPCs for that day does not affect this portfolio, this committee or this cluster. The next batch of hearings will then take place from 18th, 19th, and 20th. That's a Tuesday, Wednesday, and a Thursday. Tuesday and Wednesday, again, we've applied for full days, which we should get. Again, the EPC does not affect us on those days. Thursday the 20th, we've asked that if there's no caucus that we meet for a full day. If there is caucus the morning, we will meet from 2 to 5 on Thursday the 20th of May. That's the second batch of hearings. We then have a last batch of 1 and 2 June. We've asked for 2 full days on the 1st and 2nd of June. So just very quickly, our first take will be on Wednesday the 12th. That's next Wednesday for a full day. We have all the AGs. Then our second set will be 18, 19, and 20 of May. And then our last 2 days will be 1 and 2 June. All of them are full days, except for the 20th, which we will, if there is caucus, which I think, according to the latest program, the East Caucus, we must probably only meet in the afternoon. Not forgetting that Tuesday the 11th, that's next Tuesday, you will get notice for a different meeting, but that's a briefing by the Auditor General's office.
Let's just reiterate the 11th next week. Please don't take it off your diary. That's the usual committee day. Auditor General's office, we're hoping, will be here to give us a briefing on what they call performance audits. Which they either are embarking on or they're about to embark on with regard to the Department of Basic Education. The 12th and 13th is tentatively set down for those public hearings. The first, is it only the 12th? The 12th. The 12th then is when we kick off with the public hearing. So you should get a list of those organizations at the very least by Friday this week, right? And then, of course, the following week, Mr. Brown, you said 18th, 19th, and 20th. I want to suggest that the 20th, we just do the afternoon session, and we agree at this point so that members are not confused that we start in the afternoon, because even if the ANC doesn't have a caucus, the other parties may very well have their caucus. And then did you say the next one is the 1st and 2nd? 1 and 2 June. Okay, so hopefully we would have gone through all three of those phases that I've talked about. The oral hearings, the consideration of the submissions, and at the very least the drafting of the report at the end of the 2nd of June. So that means that there's a hell of a lot of work. And may I just give some advice to members? I know that many of you are strapped between different committees and will be in and out and so on. But when it comes to public hearings, what I find very useful is that you actually stay for every single session. because what tends to happen is that the discussions develop as we go through the submissions. And if you lose out on one or two of those discussions, you'll find that you're actually taking the portfolio committee back should you want to start engaging those issues later on. So I really want to urge that as far as possible, members clear their diaries for those days and make sure that you prioritize public hearings, which is not to say that if you really have something urgent and so on that you can't leave the public hearings, but that you're going to find yourself floundering later on, especially when we're doing the report and the recommendations. Okay? Any questions on these issues before we begin the presentation? Okay. Can we proceed, members? Lovely. DG, welcome to you and your team, as always. And let me formally congratulate you on your appointment as the Director General of the Department of Basic Education. And from now on, given my age, I won't any more be confused and call you DG without meaning it. So thank you very much for that, and big congratulations for that. And may I hand over to you? I see that we've got quite a few presentations, and I really want to just leave it to you as to how you want to deal with it, whether you want to go through all the presentations, then take questions, or whether you should re-stagger it and so on. Really up to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and thanks for the words of congratulations. Honorable members, I must apologize for being late. We were searching for the venue. I've been in this parliament for so many years, but today we got lost. I think we had the wrong venue. We went to three different venues. My apologies for that. Honorable Chairperson, we will be making three presentations. They link to the extent that the first one deals with the action plan for improving basic education, which we've branded Schooling 2025. We have, in discussion with the Honorable Chairperson, isolated two major areas on our agenda currently that is important to the Portfolio Committee and important to us. And these relate to the workbooks and the Accelerated Infrastructure Development Plan. Both the workbooks and the Accelerated Infrastructure Development Plan are two key interventions, amongst others, which we are embarking on to achieve the outcome attached to Schooling 2025. So I'm going to present the action plan, which is Schooling 2025, which is the overall framework. Following that, we'll have a presentation by Mr. Masuwe, who will present on the workbooks. He's currently the acting DDG of the curriculum branch in the department. And then the next presentation on the Accelerated Infrastructure Development Plan will be made by Mr. Mufoko, the Director of Infrastructure in the Department of Basic Education. With your permission, I will then proceed with the first presentation. Honorable Chair, we can assess at the end of this presentation whether members wish to raise questions, and then we'll pause at that stage.
Just before you continue, just make sure that we have the right documentation with us. We have one that is called Schooling 2025, and subheading is an action plan for improving basic education. I think everybody has that. Then we have Development of Workbooks, which is this one here, entitled Development of Workbooks. And then we have Key Interventions / Activities for Implementing of Schooling 2025. Is that where we would find the infrastructure stuff?
Yes, it's embedded in that presentation, remember, and we focus on infrastructure there. Thank you very much. If I can then proceed with the overall presentation of the action plan. Honourable members will recall that the Minister did announce that she intends to develop a plan, action plan for the basic education sector to improve it, to look at a turnaround. That announcement converged with what the President was seeking to do, which was to identify key outcomes for the sector and then to have institutional mechanisms that ensure that there's accountability and delivery. Those two initiatives have come together. And in terms of our minister's response, she's developed Schooling 2025, which will form the basis of her delivery agreement with the president. Honorable members will be aware that on Thursday or Friday, I think it was Friday last week, The President did sign his performance agreements with various ministers, including my minister, and that performance agreement contains measures which we seek to achieve through Schooling 2025. So in brief, that's how these various developments in the way government works in the current period are coming together. In making this presentation, I'll cover the following topics: a brief introduction, and then the purpose of Schooling 2025, the structure of the plan, the desired quality outputs, the desired grade attainment outputs, and our framework for improving schools, and then the interventions and related goals. Let me say that at this stage, the plan has been consulted twice with the Council of Education Ministers, which is the primary vehicle for guiding the system. It's made up of MECs and the minister. We've also discussed it at HEDCOM, and we're bringing it here. Currently, it's in a framework so that we can get feedback based on whether the direction is acceptable. The feedback we've got so far is that people are very happy with the direction it's taking. And by the end of this week, we'll have a more developed plan on the table, which contains much more meat. Having got approval for the framework, we're now going into further detail. Once that has been approved, we will then release it for public comment, and therefore an important milestone in that process is this discussion at the Education Portfolio Committee, Basic Education Portfolio Committee. So let me say that currently this is the plan for the plan. However, we are clear about the outputs that needs to be included in the plan, and those will be presented in detail at the end of this week. To a fairly large extent, Schooling 2025 is about consolidating existing public commitments, whether they exist in the Department of Basic Education Strategic Plan, the provincial departments, the presidency's plans, the clusters' plans, and so forth. This is a consolidation of all of those, but it's intended to render it much more strategic and ensure that it has the impact required. So the aim of Schooling 2025 is not to layer on top of existing priorities, additional priorities, but is to ensure that we identify those priorities in the system that are of a highly strategic nature. And a highly strategic nature essentially means that we want to address those things that we believe, if we are successful, will have a substantial impact on improving quality of basic education. So it's got to do with its importance by way of its leveraging significance, and also its importance by way of the extent to which it is blocking, this phenomenon is blocking effective delivery of schooling in the country at the moment. The purpose of the plan, right on the top, obviously, is to improve the schooling system. We are not doing this to plan for the sake of planning. It's supposed to be something that has a usefulness attached to it and is going to make a difference. It's also based on the need for long-term planning articulated in the Green Paper on National Planning and the policy document emerging from the presidency. It's clear that we in government are seeking to achieve a new mindset with regard to planning in two areas. There must be a very clear focus on outcomes and outputs, and that we need a more evidence-based planning approach. So those two features are key in the way we formulated this framework. In planning terms, in practical terms, this plan is significant, and I've spoken about that before in this committee. We haven't, up to this date, had a plan for the basic education sector as a whole. We've had a plan for the national department and 9 provincial plans. It's the first time we're now going to have one integrated plan, which will guide planning in provinces and schools, provide a basis for holding the sector accountable. This is critical. The presidency has a strong interest here. And then thirdly, and very important, it's to instill confidence in the public and in the global arena that South Africa has a plan to deal with the key developmental stumbling block. It's important to give people a sense of confidence that even though we acknowledge that there are challenges, some very serious in the sector, there is a plan to turn it around. There's a plan which, once scrutinized, one can say is credible and it can deliver the results we seek. So those are the three main intentions of the plan.
The other thing that has informed the way we've gone about the plan is that it must be dynamic. We've learned from previous attempts in the 60s in particular of central planning of a very rigid nature over a number of years, a 20-year plan, and that kind of rigid plans don't work because you can't predict all the conditions in the economy, in society, in the world. And therefore, everyone accepts, and we've accepted this emphatically in this plan, that the plan must be dynamic, it must be revised from time to time, and as advocated in the planning ministry's green paper, the process must have a right mix of bottom-up and top-down. This is important, and let me just emphasize why it's important. We need to make sure that we take into account what provincial and district conditions would dictate with regard to the targets we set. But at the same time, we can't allow a district or a school or a province simply to choose its targets, because the human tendency there is to choose an easy target. I mean, the golden rule is under-promise and over-deliver. So we must make sure that the plans are realistic, but at the same time, they constitute some element of stretching that school or that district or that province to achieve and to set itself on a path through which by 2025 we reach the point we want to be at. In an international comparison, it is clear that South Africa does have the basic building blocks as far as policy is concerned, but it's important to acknowledge that there are some serious flaws in existing policies and that they need to be fixed rather than, you know, elaborate new policy development, and we're not talking about completely reinventing them. The important thing, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, is that we, in a period now where we want to ensure we have policy stability, we believe that in a period of policy instability, implementation is confounded. It's very difficult for a system made up of 11 million learners, just under 400,000 teachers, to operate as one unified, coherent entity if you have policy changing all the time. Education systems take years to stabilize, and it's through a period of maturation that it becomes effective. And one of those things that contribute to its effectiveness is that teachers know in a predictable manner what the policy environment is. Parents know, officials know. And therefore, we regard this as important. We will fix policies where they need to be fixed, but we emphasize consciously the need for policy stability. So if something doesn't need to be fixed, we're not going to fix it for the sake of it. Our job is not here as policy developers. Our job here is to deliver basic education. To the extent that the policy needs to service that is the extent to which we get involved in policy development. I can elaborate on that point just in case I misunderstood. I'm not saying policy is unimportant. It is very important. It's a critical role of the National Department. A critical part of the Schooling 2025 process will be to have better sector-wide monitoring on a regular basis in a better structured manner at national level. Honourable Members will be aware that in terms of our statutory function, we have the job of monitoring the system. However, you can't monitor the system if you don't have a clear framework with measurable outputs attached to it, because then your monitoring depends on fairly anecdotal reports from provinces about where they are with regard to certain things. And that makes your monitoring task difficult and renders it ineffective. We believe that this plan will enhance significantly our monitoring function, not only for accountability purposes, but for diagnostic purposes so that we can support provinces where needed. And that's an important dimension of this plan. The department consequently is increasing its monitoring capacity, but collaboration with other organizations would be necessary and important. And then the other last dimension of the plan is the communication strategy. We will develop two versions of the plan, a technical version and a popular version. This is important because we believe the plan, whilst at one level is a delivery plan, it's a delivery strategy, and it's a plan there for technical officials to make sure they implement. But it's also at another level a plan which tells parents what their rights are, which tells teachers and learners and officials what their obligations are, and allows the oversight institutions to know against what they should measure the system, whether it's a school governing body, a legislature, or whether the business community wants to get involved in assisting. This is what the plan is there for. Therefore, it's important to communicate this plan properly. Also, as I said earlier on, it's important to ensure that the plan does inspire a sense of confidence amongst the people. Honourable members, we've identified, in response to the presidencies and the president's targets he set us, we said if we're going to do that, we need to focus on what is it that's going to allow us to achieve those four outcomes. And significantly, we need to do it in a manner where we don't add too many output goals to it, but at the same time don't put too little into it. Consequently, we're saying we need around 15 output goals, which should be central. And there are two types of output goals. One is those dealing with improvements in learning outcomes, and those dealing with improved access to education. We've maintained those two dimensions because we believe that obviously improvement in learning outcomes is central, but at the same time we're still dealing with an access challenge in the country, and therefore we've got to keep it within the strategic frame. In addition, we'll have 45 goals dealing with input and process matters. So the 45 goals are basically ways in which we seek to achieve the 15 goals. And if we achieve the 15 goals, we believe we'll be achieving what the President has set as targets for our minister in her performance agreement. Ideally, each goal will have one indicator and an annual target stretching to 2025. Honourable Chair, we've decided to have a medium-term period of 2025 so that we can have a sense of where the system needs to go to and at which point we want to reach a point of improvement and turnaround in the system. However, it's important to emphasize very strongly that when we say 2025, we don't mean it's like, you know, business as usual, let's hang around, we've got a lot of time. In the 2025, we'll have a five-year set of targets, five-year horizon, which are quite tight. And within that, a one-year set of targets. Clearly, the five-year period is critical across government, because that's a term of office of a government within our system, and therefore all planning needs to coincide with that five-year period. It's also a reasonable period in which to assess government delivery, a reasonable period for government to deliver on what it's promising. So there will be that emphasis on 5 years, and there will obviously be an emphasis on 1 year. There is a strong sense of urgency in the plan, a sense of urgency which says we need action now. Nearly all national targets are aggregations of provincial targets, and the latter will be made explicit in the plan. So we're not saying provinces must have our plan and their plan. The plans are completely integrated. We will put down why we think learning outcomes are so important for poverty reduction and economic development. For people in this room, it's an obvious thing. But very often we get asked, tell us why we should spend so much on basic education. I think it's important to commit to the people, why we think education is important for development, and then to make sure we deliver on that. In dealing with education quality outputs, it's important to focus both on improving results at the bottom and improving the overall average. And here again, this is important for South Africa. In most countries, you measure the average. You know, how are you progressing around the average, for example, of learner outcomes? In our country, because of income inequality, we see huge inequality in achievement, huge inequality in spending. And therefore, in our country, when we do any monitoring, we've got to simultaneously look at the average and look at what is happening at the level of the poorer part of the distribution curve. So we will constantly be doing that to make sure that that anti-poverty dimension is always present in this plan. So, Honourable Chair, then, if you look at the slides, you will see that we then go on to show how we will take those targets given to us by the President and convert them into the indicators and targets. We obviously have grade 3, improvement in language and numeracy, grade 6, and grade 9. What we've done there is to define the indicator, and then we've said what are the targets we set. This is very important to set them accurately, firstly, and then secondly, to set them in a manner where they're both realistic, but they stretch us to ensure that by 2025 we'll reach a point where we want the country to be. And in the last column there, you'll see where we've set the targets. Now, some people would believe they're very ambitious. Some people would believe they're not ambitious at all and they should be more ambitious. But this is something we would debate based on our technical work, based on what other countries have done and where we are currently. We believe that this is what we should suggest. The 2014 target you see in that last column has been given to us by the president. So that's there. The president has said by 2014, he wants 60% of learners in grade 3, 6, and 9 to have attained at the required level in literacy and numeracy in credible assessment being conducted. So that's the target for 2014. We're saying if that's the target, then what do we want? Where do we want to be in 2019 and then 2024? The other important issue here, Honorable Chair, is to make sure that we are fairly confident that the baseline we define is based on good, solid data and solid evidence. Currently, people throw around numbers, and as a country, it will be a huge problem if that baseline is not accurately defined. If it's too low and doesn't represent reality, we shoot ourselves in the foot. If it's too high and doesn't represent reality, it will create the incorrect notion that, in fact, we haven't progressed when we have progress. So we've got to be very, very careful about how we set that. And we've got people doing extremely hard work at the moment trying to ensure that we get that figure absolutely right. It's important then to say that these figures are subject to revision. Honorable Chair, if by 2014 we've reached the point of 70%, then obviously we'll revise the 2019 figure. But what's non-negotiable is that by 2014 we must be at 60%. We can't be under 60%. I know my contract runs out in 2015, I think, or 2014. So either way, if we don't achieve that target, my tenure will be defined in response to where we are with relation to that target. If we go to the next slide, Honourable Members, we carry on there with the targets that the Presidency has set, and we illustrate the indicator and the targets that we will work towards. We want to benchmark the speed of achieving these things, and you will recall that one of the key instruments to drive quality in the new approach that we're adopting is the annual national assessment. They'll be key for monitoring progress. Although it's important to ask and to explain how annual national assessments will bring about improvements, and we believe there are essentially four mechanisms through which it does that. Firstly, teachers will be exposed to better standards and assessment techniques. If you don't have annual national assessments that are independently set, teachers can carry on teaching, running their own tests, and believe that their teaching is effective and believe that their learners are learning. And you go on with that throughout GET. The time you get to FET, you realize when it's too late that, in fact, that has not been an accurate reflection of teaching and learning. Consequently, it's very important to give teachers a sense of what standards are at the earliest grades possible. Secondly, is to provide districts and provinces to be in a better position to devote special efforts to the right schools. Currently, we try to, but we're not getting it right, to focus our efforts on those schools that are struggling, that require intervention. ENA will help us to do that. Schools that make an effort will enjoy recognition of these efforts, and I'll speak a moment about that. And at the learning outcomes, point number four is perhaps the most important one we've seen from global evidence. Learning outcomes will be addressed in a more informed manner by the SGBs or by the parents. We've seen from the international literature that if you put these results in the hands of parents, it is perhaps the most powerful way to impact on schools, because parents then go to the school and they ask, why is our school performing at this level when the other school, which is similar to ours in terms of levels of poverty, are not? And parents then start asserting their rights, which they have in our law, to call the school to account and to call the provincial department and the national department to account. It's also to support, provide support to schools from provinces and districts where schools perform poorly within the relevant policy framework. And then it's also important to recognize good school performance, but again, there it must be on a year-on-year improvement, and it must be a high average relative to other schools facing similar obstacles. We must emphasize that point. We can't reward a one-off achievement, like it happens sometimes in grade 12 results. We also can't reward a school which only takes in learners who come from wealthy backgrounds and learners who already have proven that they are academically very competent. Schooling is not about providing for the academically advanced, whatever that would be. Schooling as a human right is for everyone. And schools who succeed are schools that can take particularly those learners who require active intervention and take them to a higher level. Those are the schools that need to be recognized. Too often we have schools at the moment who, in the pressure to be high-achieving, 100% pass rate schools, actually exclude learners who they think would jeopardize that track record of theirs. We don't want ENA to do that. Grade 12 exams in many schools have done that. You see the pamphlets of these schools when they advertise them, you know, 100% pass rate. But if you dig deeper, in many instances you find that where a child as early as grade 8, grade 9 suggests that their child may not pass grade 12, they do something to discourage their child. And we're very clear that ENA, in implementing it, mustn't do that. We mustn't have principals start taking kids in grade 2, you know, into other schools or somewhere else because they don't want to affect their grade 3 results. So it's not going to be that kind of assessment. We're very, very conscious of that. We'll have to decide very carefully about how the results are distributed. We said that the school governing body principals certainly must get the results because that's important. And we provide a historical trend and comparison to district, province, national averages, broken down by quintile so that we can have a sense of comparing like with like. We then need to debate the value of publishing the list down to the level of the school. There's a lot of criticism about this. In the UK, people have argued very strongly that what it does is it simply creates a false sense of what a good school is. And it punishes those schools that have tried to take in learners who are at risk, learners from poor backgrounds, learners who are in an area where there's a lot of behavior problems, maybe drug-related problems and so forth. Those schools are sitting with huge challenges which impact on their results. But when you publish these national results, the public don't see that, and those schools become condemned, even though the teachers are working very hard, the school principal is working very hard. So we want to avoid those kinds of perversions. So we'll have to debate that. Also, the grade 12 results will be used in a similar way. Honorable Chair, I'm not going to spend too much of time on this. We have the slide here. It illustrates how, again, with the average performance in language of grade 6 learners, what we're suggesting there by way of outcomes. And then the important thing, Honorable Chair, is that these assessments will be set by the National Department of Basic Education, the Department of Basic Education, bringing in expertise to ensure that they are credible, they benchmark, and they curriculum aligned. And it will be the same test, it's a standardized test across the country. The question that raises is, how do we ensure that our assessments compare with global assessments? To do that, we will continue with PIMS, SECMAC, and PIRL. So if there's a huge divergence between these assessments and ours, it will give us a sense of where we are pitching out. Obviously, we work with TIMS, SECMAC, and PIRLS to ensure that what they set is applicable to the countries in this basket of countries. But we believe it's important that we continue with the international assessments and we do ours. The question may arise, aren't we assessing too much? We'll make sure we assess that and we're careful about that. These assessments don't happen every year, and they happen in a sample of schools. So we'll be sure that we don't overburden our learners with assessments. The next big question around global benchmarking is, where do we set ourselves? Now, we've listed in this table the results of TIMS and SECMAC. and where South Africa found itself. You will recall that South Africa was rated quite low in both of these assessments. And we're saying that if we want to progress in the country, where do we want to be in this lineup of countries? And we're proposing there by 2012 where we think we should be, 2017 and 2022. Around 2022, we want to be at the point where Mexico and Georgia is currently. Doesn't mean that in future if they drop, we want to drop along with them. We're simply saying the point at which they occupy now, if you look at those countries, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, Cuba, United States, we want to move upwards towards those countries, and we're trying to set ourselves a target there. It's a very, very tough call, but we believe that given what we're spending, given what the country wants to achieve, given where we want to go socially and economically, it is critical that we make these advances. Again, with the next slide, I've explained how it works, so I'm not going to go into details here. It's about ensuring that all children remain effectively enrolled at school up to the year in which they turn 15. This is about participation rates, but we're saying effectively enrolled. We have high participation rates, especially after the age 15. The issue, though, is what are learners getting when they participate in schooling up to that age? So we're talking about effective participation. Improve access to children to quality ECD below grade 1. This is a critical one as well. Honourable members will be aware that we are responsible for grade R. Social development is responsible for ECD 0 to 5. As a government, we need to work hard to integrate our efforts there. But clearly with grade R, we want to ensure that we provide increased coverage, which we're doing quite well on, but we need to focus on quality now as a significant thing. One way to deal with quality, which we're doing, is to ensure that more and more grade R learners are in public schools being taught by teachers employed by the state. Improving grade promotion, absolutely critical. And again, not grade promotion simply administratively and through policy, but ensuring that learners progress through having achieved the outcomes associated with the curriculum demands at that grade. Improve access of youth to further education and training beyond grade 9. And here, our work with the Department of Higher Education and Training becomes significant. But for us, we got to ensure that in looking at the delivery of the curriculum up to grade 9, are we preparing learners for a diversity of options? Are we preparing them to go to grade 10 in an academic FET stream? Are we also preparing them to pursue other options, for example, FET colleges and so forth, training options that the Department of Higher Education and Training is offering? So it's looking at a diversity of options, which is not, we can't say it's now the Department of Higher Education and Training's responsibility, because they receive these learners from us. So we've got to make sure that whatever the learners are exposed to up to grade 9 allows them to pursue these diversity of options that the state wants to make available, and that's available through the private sector in the country. Then the quality outputs, we indicate what we want in grade R, and yeah, to draw a distinction between formal and non-formal, to try and ensure that quality is improved. Age and grade, we want to look at the outer target of reaching 5% repetition across all grades. That was a target by 2005. It's something that we haven't had very good monitoring tools on, and it's something that with the learner unit record information and tracking system, we're going to be in a much better position to track that. FET enrollments, there hasn't been good planning here, but clearly the integration between schools and FET colleges is something we've got to look at very strongly. We've put down this diagram, graphic, just to illustrate how different elements in the system come together. It's not a plan that can focus purely on what national officials do. Schooling 2025 is a plan that recognizes that there's a number of actors involved in basic education. Each of them have a role in impacting on improving the quality of basic education. the extent to which this plan recognizes their roles, recognizes their obligations, facilitates it, supports them in achieving it, and if necessary, like for example in the case of government officials and teachers, hold them accountable for delivery, is the extent to which we'll succeed. So part of its implementation would be to look at how all these different elements in the delivery of basic education comes together in a manner where it facilitates the work of others. To give you an example, unless we are able as the provincial and national departments to support schools, especially those schools that struggle, we are not going to succeed in improving basic education. And to do that, we need provincial officials, we need to bring in NGOs, we need to make sure parents play their role. And that illustrated in this graphic that clearly all these things become important. Then, Honorable Chair, if you look at the interventions, and the other presentation has got details in some of the key areas of these interventions. But the key things I'm going to summarize quite briefly now is teacher supply is vital. If we look at long-term planning and we don't monitor whether young people of the right quality and right energy are coming into the system, we're going to be in serious trouble. I must say at this point, there are very promising signs, Honorable Chair. We're finding that recently there's clear evidence of talented learners who perform fairly well in grade 12 who are now choosing to take up teaching as a profession. It's something that was receding in the last few years, honorable members will be aware. But now we're picking up these signs of people choosing to teach because they want to teach. Very good students. And we think that is an important area which we need to understand and exploit even further through our bursary scheme, through our placement scheme. But teacher supply is critical. Then, even if you've got teachers, if you don't distribute them properly, you're going to have a huge problem. Sometimes the large class sizes, are because we're not distributing teachers properly. And we're not deciding on our curriculum properly. We have too few learners taking one learning area, and that leaves too many in the other one, and one teacher to teach it, and the class size becomes big. So it's about distribution. It's a technically very demanding exercise in a system as big as ours, 11 million learners. But the point still is, we need to sophisticate even further how we distribute teachers. We also have a situation where some schools have teachers who are not the right teacher to teach mathematics, but they got mathematics historically. And somebody who can teach mathematics is in other school who's got a good mathematics teacher. So we're sitting with those distribution problems. Teacher development has been a huge, huge, huge challenge. I'm pleased, and we'll return to this committee to report on the work we've been doing to develop an integrated teacher development plan, working very closely with the teacher unions. This emerges from a teacher summit that was held last year, teacher development summit, and we're on track to meet our deadline by June to put that plan on the table across the plan. So it's going quite well, and we're hoping that now we'll have a credible teacher development strategy with buy-in, strong buy-in from the unions, costed with clear funding, identified at provincial level, clear delivery institutions, clear competency frameworks, clear ways of working with higher education institutions and other providers, to make sure that we have teacher development that can make a difference in the system. Teacher accountability, a key one. In the plan, in the strategy, and in our policy, we combine teacher support / teacher development on the one side and teacher accountability on the other side. These two must go hand in hand because sometimes the effectiveness of a teacher is due to teacher development challenges, sometimes it's due to accountability challenges, sometimes it's both. We've got to ensure that both are applied. Textbooks and workbooks, important. I won't speak in detail to that because Masue will make a presentation. School governance and management, obviously, school functionality has been identified as the key predictor of whether schools succeed or not, and that's important. School funding, again, we need to look at the adequacy of funding, but again, Honorable Chair, we believe that the way we're using current funding is not optimal, and we need to constantly work hard on that. school infrastructure, critical, and Mr. Mofoko will make a presentation on that, and then learner well-being. We've got a school nutrition program, but it's clear that over the years, as, you know, support services like health, social work, guidance counseling, psychological services, as those became less available to learners, we found that we've had problems which those interventions could address. We've just had a health screening now in partnership with the Department of Health. We're working with the Department of Health to make sure that every school has access to a clinic close by for support services, which would be primary health care facilities, and then also looking at, for example, psychological services. We're also looking at partnership with the Department of Social Development for social work services. But this is an important area to develop, because very often, if you can diagnose a problem early in grade R and grade 1, you can make a big difference to that child's future. Conversely, if you don't identify it earlier, that child has huge problems later in life. And that brings me to inclusive education. Again, an area of challenge due largely to funding. We believe there's also some policy gaps there. But again, it's an area that we want to focus on. Support by district offices to school is a critical area of intervention. So, Honourable Chairperson, what I've done is to sketch very broadly the framework. I've indicated the goals and how those link to what the President has set for us, and I've indicated the key interventions. To repeat, we are now populating the detail to have a narrative report based on the go-aheads we've been receiving and input we've received. We'll take the input from this hearing today, and we'll finalize that report, which will also be available to members. And subsequent to that, we'll take it for public comment. So, Chair, let me conclude this presentation at that point and hand over to you, Chairperson, to guide us.
I think maybe we should take the other two presentations before we open up for questions and discussion, because you may find that those questions pertain to these presentations. So, I'm not sure what we're going to do the work. Go ahead.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. I will make this presentation on development of workbooks, as DG indicated. We thought it was important, as we make this presentation, to foreground it with the kind of approach that the department has and the system has sought to take with respect to addressing this whole question of literacy and numeracy. And you would recall that as a system, we had introduced 3 years ago the Foundations for Learning program, that is the FFL, that is being indicated there. And clearly the whole approach of the Foundations for Learning process was that which sought to find the evidence that would drive the extent to which we'll be able to ensure that we have learner achievement at the right and appropriate levels. And further to say, how do we ensure that we provide for support in terms of documentation and training that would go along? So we thought it was important to give that broad overview of an intervention, that while we talk about workbooks, it is workbooks within a particular context, and it is that context that seeks to address foundational skills that all learners in South Africa should have, the literacy and numeracy skills, which are important in later years. Honourable Chair and members, what this triangle begins further to demonstrate is the approach that shows an integrated approach of 3 key aspects that, in our view, are central to getting us to achieve that we have set ourselves to do. If you look on the right, it talks about the learning, and it is the kind of learning experiences that go along with that process. It talks to the whole question of assessment, and DG has spoken to annual assessment as one aspect, but it is also important to note that in terms of curriculum development and curriculum implementation, there's also assessment, continuous assessment that takes place, which informs the teaching. And thirdly is the actual teaching itself. What are the practices that are being employed to ensure that we could get learning outcomes? So in terms of the whole outline, we want to provide the current state of performance in literacy and numeracy, because this is at the heart of why we need workbooks and other interventions that would help us to address the literacy and numeracy challenges. We also are giving an indication of the major predictors of performance, so that in whatever that we do, we are able to respond to these major predictors of performance that we've been able to gather from empirical evidence and data that we've and lastly, it is how we then address this, what has been our approach or will be our approach as we move forward with respect to addressing the literacy and numeracy challenges. Chair, this slide begins to give an indication that as a department, we wanting to be continuously guided by credible evidence of that which translates or takes place on the ground as a means of informing the types of interventions that we would have to introduce, so that our investments are also not misplaced in a way that they would not help to get us to directly deal with the challenges that we have. And clearly, the interventions would be such that they would be able to support and improve performance. And I think it's important that we always want to make sure that we address the foundational skills of literacy and numeracy. We would continue to also measure and ensure that high achievement of learning outcomes would be measured against the contextual factors, because it is important that contextual factors of access, equity, and quality that impact on learning are also taken into account. And also in this particular regard, it is how we begin then to assess or monitor the extent to which the system is performing, and our annual national assessments and systemic evaluations in this regard are an indication of the interventions that we are making. So we're just putting all of this so that it begins to give a basis upon which we would give an indication. DG has spoken about the observations that are emanating, and I will not deal with this in terms of the targets that we're moving. But we thought it was important that we give this an indication from this slide. So the major predictors from our empirical data, and we use the 2004 systemic evaluation results in this as a means of beginning to get a clearer understanding of the performance. But clearly there are key predictors of performance in terms of and we've given an indication. One of the key things that we see here is that teaching practices are fundamentally at the heart of what we would need to do. We have seen from empirical data that there's always, with good teaching practices, there's always already a 59% advantage of learners being able to attain, because of the extent to which the teacher would engage with the learning material and with the teaching practices. So you would therefore begin to understand that it is important that we give focus to that particular area in terms of what we do. Similarly, the language of learning and teaching further begins to point in the direction of that, and we are beginning to ensure that we strengthen the extent to which we would support mother tongue teaching as well as all languages in the system. So what's more important is to look at the school resources. They also have an impact, and they already give an advantage of 49%. Here's something: that access to learning materials is 28% advantage to all learners. But what it then begins to say is that while it's important to give learning and teaching support materials, what is at the heart of this is that on their own, learning and teaching materials are not necessarily a predictor that there will be good performance, and it is how you address all other factors of teaching practice, language, and other resources to ensure that these learning materials can be properly used. And I think it was important that we put these. And it is on the basis of these that we have packaged the extent to the mechanisms of direction in which we will be developing the workbook. As in terms of the support, because in terms of the support, we have spoken about this, that we had as a system put the Foundation for Learning program into the system. And the Foundation for Learning as a program had given and identified in clear terms that which teachers have to do, how they have to do it, and the resources that are required, and how assessment of learners would take place. So we thought that it was important that we give this indication. And when we then talk of basic resources that are important, I think this is at the heart of the approach to literacy and numeracy that we seek to. We have identified core material that is important to get learners. But while we may be talking of workbooks, but the strategy and the core material that has been spoken to here is that we talk to the ensuring that there are readers that are available, because there is a relationship in terms of how readers are able then to get learners to acquire the necessary reading skills and therefore the development of language. The second, it is the extent to which how we will support the development of the teaching of phonics as a means of ensuring that language development among learners will do. And the third aspect, it is the workbook package. And it is in that context that basic resources would have to begin to provide that support to schools and teachers alike. What we've also provided are assessment frameworks. And what these frameworks begin to do, they provide milestones and begin to tell teachers to assess and monitor the development of learners and know how learners would be progressing in key critical skills that we are dealing with, both at the level of literacy and numeracy. Chair, other issues that we have spoken to, those milestones, as I say, they are aligned to the curriculum, because it was important that we align these to the curriculum. We have also provided quarterly assessment activities that support teachers in terms of providing and the lesson plan. Now, when we talk of lesson plans, these have been provided for grades 1 to 6 as a means of ensuring that they provide for full coverage of the curriculum and begin to guide teachers on how to plan both for teaching and assessment in a classroom setup. It is on the basis, Honorable Chairperson and members, of these lesson plans that we now have in the system that we are now moving to the next stage of developing workbooks. And our view is that workbooks are not a standalone, and they are therefore form part of a core of materials that we need to ensure that we get into schools as a means of getting literacy and numeracy and programs to be supported. So workbooks are intended to intensify our support to teachers and learners as we work to improving that. And an important thing about these workbooks is that the content of these workbooks will be guided and informed by the key knowledge and skills that we know that and require learners to acquire per grade, because it's important that these must be graded and must also be provide for the necessary scaffolding that would be required. What would then be the purpose of these workbooks, Chairperson and honorable members as well? Our view is that the purpose of these workbooks would be to provide for quality assessment, quality activities that would also ensure that we entrench in the system good practice in terms of that which we teach to entrench literacy and numeracy as support in the system. I think it's also important that they would understand that these workbooks would offer learners an experience to acquire and apply skills in a systematic way in terms of how the learning would take place. It would further seek to ensure that we provide adequate opportunities for learners to engage in their learning experience and as a means of getting writing processes and writing responses going on. So these are the key fundamental areas that these workbooks would begin to deal with. I think our evidence through the quality improvement development program that the department had launched, we had noted that there are schools that do not have all of the basic resources that are required. And the question, therefore, is, how does the system respond to providing for such schools? And it is in the context of making workbooks available, because then teachers don't have to start around trying to get mechanisms of getting worksheets. And it is in this context that we would also then be supporting those schools, providing a model of good practice that would guide teachers. But finally, I think it's important that these workbooks would have to provide for teachers to monitor learner performance and then prepare learners for the formats of the kinds of assessments that we will be getting them to expose. The Schooling 2025 plan begins to show that we have a target of improving literacy and numeracy up to 60% by 2040. And as part of that, we would be going back into international tests. The question is, what preparation are we doing to move the system in that particular regard? And it is these workbooks that we would hope would provide for that particular intervention. Chairperson, in terms of the scope of work, we know that we will provide a workbook, for two workbooks, both in literacy and numeracy for grades 1 to 6. In other words, 12 workbooks will be provided in total. Our plans indicate that these workbooks will contain some 200 activity sheets per book. These will all be linked to the lesson plan. And I should indicate here at the moment, Chairperson, that while we talk of lesson plans that are being made available, we are in the process of translating and versioning those lesson plans into other 10 languages, because currently they are available in English, in the English language. I'm not sure but it could be seen on the presentation. We thought it was also important to give an indication of the numbers of learners that would benefit from this, and we're giving a scope of work that would be required in terms of, for every language, in terms of the numbers of learners from grade R to 6 in this particular regard. And I would hope that, I know that these figures are quite small, but if you look at Afrikaans, we're talking already at 669,000 learners. If you talk of English, it's 3 million learners that are involved. If you talk in Ndebele, you're talking 34,000 learners in total. In Sepedi, you're talking 360,000, and so on across the grades. And so this is the number of, this is the scope of work in terms of how we will get these distributed. In terms of the process to be followed, Honourable Chair and members, is that we have taken a view that we have to develop the system, the capacity of the system. And when we talk of developing the capacity of the system, is to ensure that in time, teachers, district officials, and provincial officials and national officials would be the ones that would continue to get the system to develop in terms of curriculum support, to provide for support in this particular regard. That is why we have selected a process of appointing a team of curriculum experts or material developers that we have in the system. And we will also do this in collaboration with NGOs that have been that have a reputation in terms of a credible record, rather, in terms of development of workbooks and higher education institutions. But fundamentally, it's those that have the knowledge of the curriculum, because that becomes an important aspect of how we would proceed. As it relates to the time frame, we have planned that the whole delivery process and the whole process of identifying has already started, that it will be a 5-month period during which we will develop and get to a point. But I think an important aspect is also to say, as we develop these workbooks in this phase, we would ensure that there is a strong monitoring process that is included in there, as a means of ensuring that as we get them into schools, we can get feedback that will tell us on how we should improve on these in the outer years that will come. Chairperson, it is on that basis that we would be developing the whole concept of framework of workbook. And maybe I think it's in conclusion, I should say that while we talk workbook, there are three, it is how we define our approach to improving literacy and numeracy in grades 1 to 6 in particular. And I think a key component is that while workbooks are a component, there are two other fundamental areas in terms of strategies that we have to take. It is how you make available the reader, which would provide for reading skills, and how we then support for the phonics programs. And those three taken together are an approach that we will use for ensuring that we support literacy and numeracy. Thank you very much.
I want to suggest that before we get into the next presentation, we take a 5-minute break, because I think that there's a lot of information to absorb that does take a lot out of us. So let's be back in about 5 minutes, and then we'll have the presentation. We'll go straight into discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Arrende il posto, ha fatto cosa buona. para ello. Están los se complena y lo llena.
Okay, thank you very much. I was saying that now we get to the most emotional part of the presentation, which is always interesting. Lucky you, sir. Please, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, maybe at the outset I need to indicate that we tinkered a bit with the presentation that you have in your pack, but it does not differ significantly from that one. It's just one or two slides that have been updated. That's correct. Okay. Okay, thank you, Chair. The Accelerated School Infrastructure Delivery Initiative is part of the broader 2025 vision that DG has alluded to in his presentation. But what we are talking about here is an initiative of accelerating the provision of infrastructure, looking at the backlog that we have, something that I will talk to at a later stage. So this is an initiative that is part of a broader infrastructure program that wants to bring schools to an optimum functionality level. If you remember what we are talking, when we talk about optimum functionality, we are talking about that gradation from your basic functionality, minimum functionality, up to optimum functionality. Basic functionality meaning that a school needs to have the basics like your water, sanitation, electricity, and you don't have a structure that would fall on top of learners. So the basic aim of this initiative is to accelerate the delivery of infrastructure in this current period, but as part of a broader 2025 strategy. We are putting this slide just to indicate the increase in the budgets, in infrastructure budgets over the years. These are indicative budgets over the MTEF, and these include additions for your resource centers, for your grid R classrooms, for your inappropriate structures, that some refer to as smart schools and so on, your Planky school, libraries and laboratories. But the truth of the matter is that irrespective of this increase in the budgets in terms of infrastructure, this is still not enough to deal with the infrastructure budgets that we have. And there is a need for additional interventions in order to deal with the backlog, and hence this accelerated initiative. The basic functionality backlog that I alluded to, these are schools in all the provinces that still have challenges with regards to water, sanitation, electricity, and inappropriate structures. And this comes from our NIMS database. And in total, we have about 5,640 schools that are still challenged in terms of these basic facilities. And that is why we have focused on basic functionality to say we cannot afford to have these kinds of schools in our system, and those are the priority one type of schools that we are targeting in this accelerated infrastructure initiative.
We are currently looking at going through provinces in verifying these numbers. For instance, just to indicate, last week we sat with Limpopo and Mpumalanga. For instance, the figure that we got in Limpopo is that they have about 777 schools, and as opposed to 702 schools that we have in our database. But for instance, when we went to Mpumalanga, the number has dropped from 505 to 152, with about 98 schools that are still being verified. So the figure might increase, or it might decrease or increase, depending on the situation and the level and the speed of delivery in provinces over the years. This is just to show, for instance, in KZN, the situation that we have. The number of schools differ per district and municipalities, and this is going to assist us in terms of targeting particular districts as priorities. You have districts, for instance, if you look at your KZN situation, you have Kanyude and Sisonge, for instance, where you have some serious challenges with regards to basic functionality. This is just indicative, and this is the situation throughout the country and in different provinces. Now, the Accelerated School Infrastructure Initiative, as I have indicated at the beginning, the target is those schools that are below basic functionality, those schools that do not have water, electricity, sanitation, and inappropriate structures. As I have indicated, that despite the budget that you have and the increase in budget, the money that we have in the system is still not enough to provide those facilities that we need. Hence, we are looking at loan funding in order to provide additional impetus to the provision of infrastructure. Obviously, you would need some partnerships as well. We are looking at private sector companies to provide additional funding as well. And linkages, what we are saying is that with the budget that I indicated in the second slide, provincial infrastructure programs will continue. We have approved provincial infrastructure plans for the current financial year and for the MTEF. Those programs will continue, but this program that we are proposing will run concurrently with your existing provincial infrastructure program. This slide shows the timeline that we are proposing. That will be the duration. Your year zero will be the current year in which we are. That would be the year that would be doing the setting up and the planning and procurement. From year one, year two, year three, that would be your project implementation up to year five, where we'll be doing handover. The slide also shows that lower down, your provincial infrastructure program will be continuing while we are implementing ACD. The intention is that as the number of schools, you will have a bigger number of schools at the beginning of the program, and the number of schools that we are targeting will decrease. What we are looking at also is that mostly your provincial infrastructure program at the end of this particular program would be in terms of your new schools and in terms of your maintenance of existing schools, and also to provide additional spaces like laboratories, your administration blocks, your sports fields, and so on. Those are facilities that will be provided as we move on into the next phase of the program. The proposal here is that this is just the structure of the program in the manner in which it is going to be managed. You will have a task team at the National Department of Education that will be coordinating the whole program. Then you, at the level of provinces, you would have a similar task team. And what we are proposing in terms of this particular program is that in terms of procurement, you will be dealing with schools in terms of clusters. In this instance, we are trying to take advantage of economies of scale, that you don't go into one school, provide it with facilities, and move out and come back to a school next door 2 years or 1 year later. That is not cost effective. What we are looking at is that schools will be clustered in terms of packages, and those packages will be based on education districts. And as you provide facilities to those schools, you will also be looking at your feeder, both up and downstream feeder schools, to see if those schools do need some form of maintenance, some form of additional classroom, and so on. So in a sense, The 5,000 that we are targeting as schools below basic functionality, at the end of the program, we will have dealt with far more than 5,000 schools, because we will be dealing with schools in the feeder areas of the 5,000 schools that we have identified already. The focus, basically, what we will be doing, all schools based below basic functionality. When you go into a school, we will rehabilitate dilapidated buildings. We'll demolish and replace dilapidated buildings, add classroom, toilet, administration blocks, water and electricity, and so on. I have already alluded to that. Now, how are we going to do this? These are the strategies, a combination of strategies that we are going to use in order to ensure that we succeed with this particular program. First of all, we are in a process already of developing what we refer to as standardized school designs, specification, and tender documentation. Now, this would be done to facilitate the tendering process, and also to facilitate the construction process. And also, this will assist us in opening up opportunities for rapid mobilization of contractors on site. Remember, this is a five-year program, and we need to make sure that contractors get on site as quickly as possible. We will also introduce alternative technologies and delivery systems to address particular needs rapidly. What this means that we are not only going to rely on your brick and mortar structures in this particular program. And we have already started with a number of schools. For instance, with your Axelo Middle donation, we are dealing with a school in Mamelodi that was built in about 8 months, and it's quite a beautiful school. So the use of alternative technologies is very critical to this. Mobilization of major contractors. We are looking at mobilizing contractors with CIDB grading of 6 to 9. We know that there are a few such contractors in the country. But these contractors will be mobilized through bulk tenders for a large number of classrooms. And in this way, we'll be able to deal with a large number of schools in quite dispersed situations. And also, we will be using your medium-sized contractors for your smaller schools. For instance, if you have to add three or five classrooms, six classrooms, then we will be using your medium-sized contractors. The use of experienced construction managers. These would be used to oversee the work of a number of contracts or through awarding construction management contracts. We will also need experienced program and project managers. I will elaborate on this when I'm dealing with the management structures. These particular project and program managers, the task of these would be to manage large contracts in order to ensure effective management and control and monitoring. And also your public-private partnership, that is one strategy that we need to look into in terms of providing. Now, the management structure for this particular initiative, you will have your Department of Education as a client, and you would have a program implementing agent who will act on behalf of the department. Your program implementing agent would be responsible for all issues relating to project management, for all issues relating to quality control, for all issues relating to expenditure control, time management, and reporting. In turn, your program implementing agent would appoint professional service providers to manage a cluster of projects. I have alluded to the issue of geographical clustering, and that is where your professional service providers would come in. And your professional service provider then would manage your contractors, and your contractors would appoint your subcontractors. We will ensure that your small and medium scale contractors are part of this whole program. So this is the management structure that we are proposing in terms of managing this. Your program implementing agent would be reporting to the Department of Basic Education as you outlined. And in terms of the structure that I have alluded to, your program implementing agent, we will be appointing at least a program implementing agent and a professional service manager per province to ensure that you have that kind of control per province. Funding, I have alluded to loan funding for this particular program. We have been in discussion with the National Treasury and the Development Bank of South Africa in terms of this. And this is the arrangement that is going to be followed in terms of the funding, that you'd have a tripartite agreement between your Treasury, the Development Bank of South Africa, and your Provincial Education Department. And through that arrangement, your Provincial Education Department will take a loan from the Development Bank of South Africa. And arrangements through the National Treasury will be formulated to ensure that funds are committed towards the repayment of loans beyond the current MTEF allocation. What are we doing currently? At the moment, we are in discussions with National Treasury officials and the DBSA to develop the funding model and the funding arrangements and the procedures and monitoring and reporting mechanisms for this particular program. And also, as I've indicated at the beginning, we are consulting with the affected province. We have started with the four critical provinces, which is your Limpopo, KZN, Eastern Cape, and Mpumalanga. We have already sat with them. We have determined their backlog and projects that would be part of this ICD program. The team, as I speak, is speaking today with Northwest. We will be speaking with the other provinces before the end of next week, so that at the end of this, we have an indication of how much are we going to need and how is it going to be implemented. Concurrently, we are developing an implementation plan. The management structures and all those strategies that I have alluded to are part of the implementation plan and the strategies that we are going to use. This would be submitted to senior management and all the structures for approval purposes. And then we will implement the plan and monitor. What is critical about this plan is that we want to ensure that by the end of this strategic planning period, we do not have a school that is without water, a school that is without sanitation, a school that is without electricity. And we have eliminated all your dangerous structures, your mud school, your plank school, your metal school, and so on. That is the strategic focus of this in terms of this program. Mm-hmm. Over and above that, we will be providing spaces, as I've indicated. As you provide those facilities, water, sanitation, your basic functionality services to those schools, you will be providing those schools with your core spaces as well, your libraries, your laboratories, your administration blocks, and so on, to ensure that as you go out of a school, you don't have to come back and come and provide a school with a library. That wouldn't be cost-effective, as I have indicated. As you go into a school, you will be providing a school with a package of facilities that a school will become functional as you move out of that. That is, in short, Chairperson, what we intend doing in terms of infrastructure in this current strategic planning period. Thank you very much.
Peter, you
want
to have a last word?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Just a few things to add to the presentations. On the workbooks, as Mr. Masu has indicated, we're looking very strongly at linking the workbook initiative to our teacher development initiative and annual national assessment. It's important to see those as integrated. Very often teacher development fails when you try and create teacher development separate and abstracted from what teachers do in the classroom. The workbooks is trying to compensate for real problems we picked up in the classroom, as Mr. Masu has reported. And what we want to do in delivering the workbooks is to link it to teacher development, link it to district support, so that it has an impact in the classroom. And we leave the workbooks, therefore, with the teacher and the teacher guide. As far as annual national assessments are concerned, the workbooks will try to anticipate what's expected in the annual national assessment by way of activities. The other issue to emphasize is, Mr. Masu has indicated, we'll translate the lesson plans and workbooks into 10 languages. We need to emphasize that we're not simply going to develop, for example, the literacy workbook, and once it's done, translate it. Because very often, that doesn't work. It isn't a direct translation. Because some of the phonics that you use in different languages are different. So what we'll do in developing core version, which will be in English, will have people of the different language leaders, developers, sitting alongside the development process. So it will almost be a simultaneous development. But at the end, we don't simply directly translate a word book, especially the literacy and languages one. The mathematics one may be easier to translate. So that's the other thing. The other important thing, Honorable Chair, is that in deciding to do it internally, and when I say internally, I mean bringing in outside experts, but it's not going to go out on tender to a provider. The main motivation for that is now we're going to create capability in the system to do this, not just for this workbook, but on an ongoing basis. Secondly, the intellectual capital that we accumulate through this process will reside with the system, and that's critical. We'll also allow our officials an opportunity to grow as developers. So that's what I wanted to say by way of the workbooks. Also to say that what we're trying to address as well in the workbooks is the need for example, in languages, we know we need to create a text-rich environment. It's not just about using the language. It's about developing a love for reading, being able to analyze things and apply knowledge. So in addition to the workbooks, we're addressing readers, age-appropriate readers across the grades, and a way of addressing phonics. So they'll have those three things in each classroom that we feel is a gap currently for learning. Then on infrastructure, it's important to note that our focus is on the areas of functionality, you know, schools that are not functional as a critical challenge at the moment. And if you look at the figures Mr. Mofoko put up, about 50% of those schools are in Eastern Cape and KZN. So that's like a major focus for us. The funding mechanism he spoke about is an innovation. It's about bringing money forward that should have been on our budgets over a multi-year period. We're trying to get it now to accelerate development. The innovation is important. And then lastly, just to emphasize the point Mr. Mofoko made, we're going to work very closely with provinces around school mapping and planning, because we want to ensure that the schools are built in the right places. There's two problems we have. One is migration is a big issue, and there's a problem where you can build a school in the wrong place. The other thing is that sometimes local politics intervenes, and you build a school where the demand is greatest, you know, in terms of the local political voice. We want to ensure that we build it based on population demographics and education needs. So we work closely with the provinces there to make sure that we, whatever money we spend, there's a lot of money being spent, that is being spent in a manner that's going to make a difference. Thank you, Chair. Honorable Chair.
Thank you, DJ, and I think that all of the presentations were particularly valuable. And no doubt, as and when the action plan develops around Schooling 2025, we will be engaging with you with some of the detail that will emanate from the processes that you spoke to. I'm going to open up for questions. Can we start with questions of clarity first? Yeah, questions on clarity, yes.
One of procedure, more than clarity. Can we get digital versions of all these presentations sent to us, please?
Digital version, yes. Will you be able to send it to Mr. Brown? Mr. Brown will send it to all members. Oh, you've got it. Yeah, but I think this last one here that we don't have, and you'll see that even though we said that it's incorporated into this larger one, it actually isn't. There's some slides that are not here. So I think if you were to just do that one, that would be good. Yes, Ms. Moshwana.
Thank you, Chairperson. Clarity seeking question on 2-2-8-3-G.
On
the first presentation, 2025.
Yes. Yes.
I see that there's no page. Okay, it's on page 10 or slide number 9. 2024, it's like we end up at 90% for both literacy and numeracy. I'm checking, is it impossible to get to 100 or can never say 100? Or do we just want to stop at 90%? That's what I wanted to check with you.
Can I also just, in relation to that slide, just clarify that as I understand it, what we are saying is when we talk about percentages, we're talking about the number of learners that you hope to acquire certain minimum levels of competency, but that those levels of competency are not necessarily included in here. So in other words, you've got a set standard that you want people to achieve, but you want 40% of your learners to be at that level by a certain date, 50 by a certain date. So that's how I read this. Yeah? Okay, let's just get clarity on Ms. Mishwana's question as well.
It's a very important question, and by 2024 we've looked at, you know, different countries, what speed they go at and so forth. And we're trying to look at the level of development of the country at that point in time in 2024. And if you look at levels of development, it's difficult in a country at the point at which we'll be at in 2024 to have 100% in grade 3 achieving or those grades achieving that. But certainly as a country, we can set that as a target. So it's part of the consultation process. But no country achieves 100% at that level because, you know, even if you look at, like, inclusive education and special needs, there's a percentage of learners who need extra intervention to achieve that level. So even the advanced countries don't reach that. But the point is, I think the spirit of your question is important. Why can't we as a country aim high? And it's something we must think about. Yeah.
Do I also understand that while, you know, I may not be alive in 2014, given my age, certainly won't be corpus mentis by 2014. do I understand the targets to be read incrementally over the year so that I can, out of this, extrapolate that for 2010 there must be a certain target, 2011 it's incremental over that period?
Yes, Onguche, it is incremental, but it's not like, if I just speak mathematically, it's not proportional. So we can't say in 2014 if it's 90 and in 2012 it's 80, therefore in 2011 it will be 85, because the curve doesn't go straight. The curve starts slow, and then as you accumulate capacity in the system, it gets steeper.
It accelerates.
So
yeah.
it will increase incrementally, but along that kind of curve. I know that makes sense.
No, it makes sense mathematically, but
yeah.
what will help us is if we get specific figures for from 2011, 12, 13, so that we see those figures and that we don't just extrapolate.
At least up to 2014, because then after we can't be too specific year on year, so we'll be at bigger intervals, but up to 2014, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Ms. Gina?
I'm worried about the target on physical science. There was the, I know we have performed that testing last year. Now I don't know whether there is a target condition. There is nothing there.
That's a good question. Well, we've got question marks here. So.
Oh, I see. Oh, the targets. Okay, no, that's no. We're simply saying we need to do more work to populate that. But no, we definitely put it in. We just want to make sure that the problem with the 2009 is that Umalusi said that the paper was too difficult. So we're talking to Umalusi to say, are you serious about that? Because if that's the case, then the 2009 results would have been higher than it is now. So we don't want to set an easy target for 2014. So that's just the issue we need to fix up. But definitely we'll put a target to that. Thanks.
I think 2009 is definitely a bit of an aberration there, and clearly that's going to affect, because even if you double that figure, the 2009 figure, it would be on the basis of an aberration. So, yeah. So we look forward to, as I say, some of the detail we'll be getting as they progressively work on this stuff. Let's just go on to questions of clarity on the infrastructure one. Now, hang on, I've got to find the right one. Okay, let's just reiterate some of these issues of clarity, right? Firstly, as I understand the what do you call this infrastructure, accelerated schools infrastructure delivery initiative. You people are very big on words. Okay, so do I understand the funding mechanism to be essentially what you're doing is you're enabling the provinces to borrow money up front that would come into their budgets, that are projected to come into their budgets in the future. Now, to what extent is that projected into the future? In other words, is it from now till 2014, or is it from now till 2025, let's say? Obviously, some provinces should be longer than others, yeah? Is that basically what the plan is? So it's not a national department's initiative. This will still be done by provinces basically calling in monies earlier than they would have gotten it in any case, so that they can start their projects earlier and that by that stage they'd be paying off debt.
Yes, very much so, Honourable Chairperson. This is the money intended for provinces, so therefore it's money that will be appropriated off their votes in the legislature, but it's money that comes from the National Treasury in the block grant that goes to provinces. The way it's being facilitated is a discussion between Department of Basic Education and the Treasury involving the provinces. We're having a 10-by-10 with the Treasury soon, which brings together the two ministers from Treasury and Basic Education and the heads of department on both sides. And one of the issues we're discussing is this. So to facilitate it, the national ministers are discussing how this can be done, because you need to have a legal mechanism to make it work. The issue, the challenge, as you rightly say, is that the budgets are firm for the MTEF. That's clear, and that can be done quite easily. Using a facility which is similar to what the World Bank does, like ESCOM has done now, to say, lend us money, and what we intended to spend in our CAPEX budget over the next 20 years, which they projected, we'll use to pay off the loan. So it's that sort of idea. But because the MTF is only defined for this MTF period, the Minister of Finance now has to do some hard work to say, given where we're going as a country, given what we anticipate, broadly speaking, the fiscal framework will be, given what we anticipate we need to do in terms of basic education being the number one priority, what can we say is an appropriate amount? Obviously, they'll calculate it in a manner where they think it's fairly conservative. So it may end up that we'll get more. But that's basically what it is. It's something that a country has to do very carefully because you then commit the budget for the next 10 years. And I think the Minister of Finance will be very careful about the period through which it's committed. It's easy for him to commit it for the MTF. That's easy. Beyond that, it becomes increasingly difficult as you go beyond the MTF. But what the Development Bank of South Africa will do is essentially they'll structure the loan in a manner where it will be a soft loan. So the interest on it will be very, very low, because the guarantee for that loan is being provided for by the National Treasury. The last detail which the DBSA will work out finally is that what they may do is borrow the money, not take it from the Treasury now, but then the Treasury will give them the money. It will be voted off the provincial budget still. It will appear in their estimates, but it won't go to the province. It will go into the DBSA account.
I had no doubt that the bank was going to get its money back. That part I was quite sure of. But what I was not quite sure of is to what extent the provinces are committed to agreeing to this. What is your sense?
They are committed to it. This matter was raised in the PCC, which is the Presidential Coordinating Council, where the President meets with the Premier. It was discussed. Certain questions were raised that we need to work through. Certainly, we're not going to take over the delivery function of provinces. That's critical. We're not going to take over we're not going to take over local economic development imperatives. But what the President has said, we need to balance that against the imperative to deliver. So those things are going to be combined. So the provinces are on board. When we have the 10-by-10 I spoke about, increasingly they'll be on board. And this plan will be jointly developed and owned by the province, but facilitated by the national department. The Minister of Finance needs to give the okay to it in terms of law. The Minister of Basic Education has very little function in law in relation to this matter.
So tenders, the issue of exactly where these schools are located, all of those things become issues that the provinces would actually deal with.
They will deal with administering those things, but they want to play a role, for example, in the planning to say, let's agree where the schools should be. We've set norms and standards for infrastructure, a long range of things, including costs. We're finding that, for example, in one province, a 30-classroom school would cost, let's say, 50 million. In another province, it would cost 115 million. You send people there, they can't see a difference that justifies that variation. So we say national has a role to play in terms of its statutory functions, to say that if you're spending on a school, this is the range. Maybe, you know, the land may be a bit of a problem, so you have to spend a bit more, but it can't explain a jump from 50 million to 100 million. So to that extent, national will be involved. So it will be largely joint, but the actual procurement and so forth will happen at a provincial level. It's their money.
There will also be norms and standards, DG, on the issue of where schools are located in terms of the number of students that the schools serve. Because I do, while I understand the imperative around mud schools and so on, we need to get those kinds of basic things right. Oftentimes, we don't take into account the issue of urbanization, for example, people moving out of these towns and villages into bigger centers, where, by the way, I'm very surprised that I don't see Gauteng featuring prominently for that very reason. Urbanization happens mostly in Gauteng, and it seems to me that overcrowding happens in those. And while you can't necessarily compare it, for example, with the Eastern Cape, where you still have mud structures and so on, and or KwaZulu-Natal, which is quite a hugely populated province. It's those kinds of things that worry me. That you know, for us to say, okay, well, you know, we're getting rid of mud schools and we don't have a single mud school there. We overlook the fact that perhaps, you know, the school that we're putting up for 50 million for 700 kids, as opposed to 7,000, which is in a different district, and there the schools are dilapidated and so on, while they have running water, while they have basic infrastructure. You know what I'm talking about.
That is a critical issue that has plagued us since 94, Honourable Chairperson. One of the biggest planning challenges in the country with housing and schools and hospitals is migration, and it's very dynamic. It's been huge in South Africa. Now and then it quietens down and then it takes off again. It's become predictable in some senses, but also unpredictable. So we have that problem. And there have been mistakes where a school has been built because of an assumption of population. And then that population shifts, very often migrates out and into Gauteng, into Western Cape, and so forth. So we've had that urbanization phenomenon, which now demographers are telling us is shifting again from urban into peri-urban. So there's been a shift into urban, there's a shift again out, and we're trying to chase that. The other issue that's there, which is not a migration to urban areas, but it's a parental choice migration of learners out of townships. So we built expensive schools, for example, in townships, right? Take Umlazi or Soweto or something. And the parents then move learners out of there. So people are still living there. It's still densely populated. But move them to the peri-urban or suburban schools. So that's another phenomenon, and that's a quality issue. The other thing is that we need to link policy to school infrastructure. Because in the past, we felt that small schools are not viable. So we tried to create, you know, big schools. But then we had huge problems with transport and learner safety and so forth. We wanted to get rid of multi-grade teaching. Now we're saying, look, from a curriculum point of view, maybe multi-grade teaching is not a problem. Which, if you do that, then small schools become an option. Also, we're saying, let's use hostels more creatively. Gauteng's got a very interesting experiment now, where they're building hostels, not for one school, but hostels for a range of schools in that area. Now, from an infrastructure point of view, that's an interesting option for us to consider. I'm raising that to say we'll have to look at our policy links to infrastructure development around the issues that you're raising, to make sure that we build the schools in the right places, and it has the most productive impact on what we're trying to do. But clearly, these images we get every year of learners learning in schools without a roof, without ablution facilities. That's what Mr. Mofoko is talking about, that we really need to target and this, you know, really target it to say what are the key functionality issues and fix those things up now.
Just tying down around maintenance budgets, because one of the key things, you know, we always talk about infrastructure, but we never look at the fact that actually your infrastructure budget is only really 50% of your total cost, and the other 50% is maintenance. Now, you'll be able to tie down provinces on the infrastructure budget in the sense that you're obviously going to get agreements and so on with the banks. But going forward, is there any discussion, planning around maintenance of these very schools that you're going to be putting up? Do you see the kind of problems that we're talking about when you go to provinces and schools that are really very good schools simply are not able to be maintained simply because the infrastructure is very good, but things need to be maintained and their budgets are not taken care of. And oftentimes what happens with maintenance in our schools is that it's left to parents and the SGBs to raise money for maintenance. Now, that may work in schools where people can afford to do that, but it doesn't work very well where people can't afford to do it. And bearing in mind that a lot of these schools that you're going to be targeting now are going to be in areas where people can't afford to keep up maintenance, it seems to me that there's a very important role to be played around this issue of maintenance.
No, definitely, Honorable Chair. 99 already, government realized that on all its infrastructure, maintenance has been a huge problem. We're talking about schools, hospital, roads, it's a huge problem. So we've tried from that time already to factor it in. But you're right, we don't succeed always about getting provinces to make sure the allocation's made and that allocation reaches school and the maintenance happens. Currently, we've got two ways in which maintenance happens. We talk about routine small maintenance, where the money is transferred to the school, fixing up windows, you know, taps and so forth. The money goes to the school, the principal can procure and fix. In some cases, it's working very well. In some cases, the money doesn't get to the school, and we run into problems. We're trying to fix that up. Big maintenance is where the challenges lie in some provinces, and part of this plan includes the norming of maintenance in the budget and the planning. The other issue is that we're trying to look at the burden of maintenance and dealing with that. A lot of the maintenance comes about because of theft in schools and vandalism, because of too much of pressure on the school. The school's supposed to cater for 500, got 1,000 learners in it, and that creates a problem. Poor construction, of the schools and so forth. We're trying to address those issues as well, which in the long term will bring down maintenance costs. And we find a simple thing like the QLTC has improved the burden of maintenance in schools, where computers don't get lost, windows don't get broken, because the parents and the community are actively involved in the school. Library books stay in the library and so forth. Thanks.
Okay. All right.
Arriving out of that, DG, I take it then this infrastructural spending is not being done on the basis of equitable share between the provinces. Have you judged everything, every school by an objective standard, or have you left it up to the provinces to say to you, well, look, we have so many schools without laboratories, for instance? I'm thinking particularly of a school in my constituency in Soweto, which had two laboratories which have been destroyed by thieves. Is that school now counted as a school that has had laboratories and they don't get any more, or are they going to be replaced?
Let's take a round of questions. Yes, Ms.
Mda. Yeah, go ahead. Thanks, Chair, and also let me add my voice in congratulating the DG on his appointment. I would have wanted to see him coming back because I have seen the commitment in him. So I congratulate you as well. My question, Chairperson, is going to be on the first document, which is the Vision Schooling 2025. And I will be going to slide 6. I don't see pages, but I think slide 6 is numbered, where it talks of the critical part of Schooling 2025 being sector-wide monitoring. I would want to check, DG, based on this, have you done any visibility study that has indicated what have been the issues that has made monitoring not to attain the department the desired results on this particular in the previous time. And if those that visibility study has given you lessons, what are the exact issues that you think needed to need to be given priority and focus? Because I know that monitoring is always a commitment from every government department, but I think on this particular one, at least a better detail of the areas that you are actually referring to, because I'm sure you know that at a national level, as a department, you would put your departments provincial and districts, but you would find that it does not cascade to and talk to the plan as you would have wanted it to be. And also to on the slide, on slide 18, Chair, I'm not sure whether I would be correct to ask this question, but if, Chair, I'm asking it to an administrator rather than a politician, you will correct me. I'm checking that it says on under the age and grade, just below grade R. I'm trying to check whether the department does not intend to review its stance on the fact that says learners are expected to start schooling at the age of 7, that is at an entry level being grade R. And looking at the how the space educationally and otherwise is evaluating now, isn't it maybe time that we review that stance, Chairperson, and maybe consider, because I'm looking at the age that these learners, when they start at the age of 7, they're expected to finish at grade 12. They're a bit older than the class that they are, and seeing that now at the level of 21, you would find that other people are actually starting working. Don't we think that maybe we may want to arrive at a point where we may even want to review that stance going forward? Thanks, Chair.
Meaning, Ms. Nda, a younger starting age?
So maybe like 5 years as an entry.
Ms. Gina?
Chairperson, thank you. On the first presentation on slide 5, I'm just interested to know, as it has been quoted that there are serious flaws in the existing policies that are there within the department. As to say, is there any consultative process that is taking place, as to say, amongst the stakeholders that are there, where they can come up with some of the things where they are not happy with the policies that are there? Because at the end of the day, I think we need to be careful as to say there will be changes in the policies just because there have been changes of hands and all those things. I think we need to be very careful on that one too. And again, still on that one, when talk of policies, I'm just thinking of this chance. It's annual national assessment. Anna, that is why it's how you appreciate it. As to say, how do you consider that versus the policy that is there, that is existing in our schools, where you look at the child repeating the grade, as to say you cannot remain in the same phase for more than 4 years. And just looking at that child where it is seen that the child is not ready, looking at the annual national assessment, but according to the policy that is already existing, that child has been there in that phase for more than 4 years. And those, I think, they will be very much concerned. How are we going to address that? Meaning to say, is this an assessment talking to the existing policies that are there? Are we not going to see some of the contradictions which will a little bit confuse the people that are teaching down there? Secondly, Chairperson, my other question is on slide number 23, where it's talk of school funding, where there are still improvements that need to be done. I can be happy if the DG can talk to that around the issue of these section 20 and 21 schools, where we see most of the time the schools are being frustrated according to that. How are they planning to correct the thing? Lastly, Chairperson, on slide number 20, in the distribution of teachers, we know that when we go to the rural areas, that is where it's still difficult for us to attract educators to go and teach in those in those areas. And I say, really, it is a need that you need to distribute these teachers equally. And there are OSDs that are there in place trying to attract the rural allowances and all those things. If the DG can explain to us how far they are they with that, are they winning, is there any improvement in the attraction of teachers towards those rural areas where we see the need of teachers being attracted there. Lastly, say, is there a connection between these foundations for learning and also the workbooks that you are waiting for them to be rolled out? And also, I know it has been said that they will be written in a very simple way so that the educators can understand them. But we know the challenges that are always there with the new things that are coming down there to the schools. Is there any program or a plan as to how is this thing going to be introduced to the educators so that we know that come next day everybody is willing and in the position to kickstart with these workbooks that have been given to them? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, just a small comment followed by a small question. Slide number 23, learner well-being. I'm personally very, very excited about the mentioning of a psychological services, although it is not there, but I think in your comments you touched on, you know, psychological services in schools. I think this will be a very, very, very good step in the right direction. This reminds me, I know the chairperson may not like me to go further than, but I'll try to be very brief. This reminds me of a small story about a child who did not do his homework, went to school, and he got 6 of the best on his buttocks. Now, 2 hours later, a parent arrived at the school to the principal's office, reported that, you know, the mother passed away last night. Now, the poor boy got something on his buttocks because he was not asked why he didn't do his homework. He was just given, you know, normally when you have things like psychological services in the school, teachers are conscious. You know, you can pick up problems, you know, from the faces of your children. This child is sad today. Why are you sad? And so on. So I just want to add that this is very, very important. When we talk of psychological services, we must not only think in terms of psychometric testing. I'm not thinking about that. That has its own, you know, problems. But pure psychological services, wellness there, is very, very important. But now the question is, in the same vein, are you also thinking in terms of bringing back remedial intervention? I don't know if it is there, but in my own observation, it looks like there is no remedial intervention. Every teacher is expected to do remedial intervention, but to be very honest, if it is an honest intervention, you need, you know, a real remedial teachers. They could be itinerant or they could be, but whatever, as long as you've got remedial intervention in the school, obviously even this problem of reading and numeracy will really be addressed, you know, from another angle. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, and DG, wishing you the best in the implementation of the plan. Though I do have some few comments on it, because as you said, that the plan itself is to, as well, instill confidence in the public. My take will be that, yes, at the theoretical level, that may happen, giving the country hope that we're getting somewhere. But I think what will matter the most is the actual implementation, the delivery of that will come out of this particular plan. You also hinted that we need some stability in terms of policies. But the other argument will be that the policy may only be stable in terms of their implementation, as long as they are able to stand the test of time. if when faced with particular challenges, they happen not to be very suitable, obviously you can't insist on them. There will be challenges on the ground. There may be no desired outcomes, and that will be a problem. But my actual questions will be one, that how enforceable will be this particular plan in provinces? Because even if they're coming onto the party by way of just cooperation, but when they have to account their account within their own cabinet or their own provincial plans, then it may as well bring about some challenges here and there. The second is that we're expecting SGBs to be able to deal with learning outcomes and so on and so on, so that there's proper functioning of those particular schools. But I know that in most rural areas or rural provinces, the capacity of SGBs to do that is found wanting. And I don't know exactly what will be done to ensure that they can as well play their rightful roles when that comes to happen. The last chair, or last but one, whether we have got the national data system that will help capture all this, particularly in terms of the implementation of the plan. For instance, even when the slides on infrastructure was being presented, you will find that the system is not necessarily talking to one another, provincial and national. Where in Mpumalanga, for instance, it said that at national level we have got 505 schools that need some serious intervention. But now, as and when you compare that with the province, they come to someone or something. So it shows some flaws that within our own system we may need to work on. But I'm saying in terms of implementation and achieving what the plan says, are we able to centrally deal with that? At some point we refer to some system that may need to be dealt with when you appoint some people and so on. We'll see what happens. The other will just be information sharing or distribution across the board. There are things that when we go on the ground and check, you find they still don't happen. At the national level, you are told this is what happened, this is the kind of workbook that went out, and so on and so on. But upon verifying, you find that either districts or whatever within your structures still haven't done some work in that particular area. So I'm saying that distribution, ensuring that what you know at this level is known to the teacher on the ground, I think that will be very, very important. Thanks.
Ms. Mushwana.
Thank you, Chairperson. On I think it's slide 20, accelerated schools infrastructure delivery. Maybe I need to add my voice. We congratulate you. It's like everybody is doing it. I can't afford not to. We congratulate you, and we feel so honored to have somebody like you driving this process. Now, on this slide, I appreciate that, that there's a task team at the national level, task team that will be checking issues. That's my understanding, as this infrastructure issue is unpacked. And it also goes down to the provincial level. But I don't see it when we go to the district. I know that we have clusters of schools there, but without the task team to continue with what was started at the national and provincial, I fail to understand how there will be effective feedback on that one. Actually, it was going to be another clarity when the chairperson came with more clarity on my question. Then the next one is a question. When you talk of infrastructures, I note that we are not talking of administration blocks yet. And most of the schools in rural areas do not have that. It's like one class has been turned into an administrative block, that schools are dying to have these so that they'll be able to run like schools across the
Star Road, the schools in the city, and the like. And did somebody say that there's going to be water in every school within this particular budget? I want to get it correctly because we don't want to go there, and because people like to ask questions if they know that you are in this particular committee. And you say yes to something that is not meant to be, might be problematic to the national level. And finally, I don't see where grade 7 fits. I know that there's been this notion for many years that grade 7 belongs to the senior phase. But when I look at it, it's like it belongs nowhere. Because here we have got the support system where lesson plans are drawn, and it's up to grade 6 only. And if you continue to look at things done for senior phases, it's like grade 8 to grade 12. Now, where exactly is grade 7? Because it was like said, it should belong to senior phase, but practically they are still very much attached to intermediate phase, unless if it's only the place where I come from. Thank you very much. And I emerge from two provinces, by the way, thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I'll start, and then my colleagues will pick up some of the questions as it pertains to their presentations. Let me thank all the Honorable Members for the words of congratulations again. And then I'll start with Mr. Lorimer's question, an important one, two parts to the question. The one is, infrastructure allocations don't follow the equitable shape, even in terms of the block allocations. It's based on an assessment of backlogs. Infrastructure backlogs is the problem. And that is based on the Treasury's information on infrastructure, which is general, but for school infrastructure. They've been using the school register of needs, and now NIMS, to decide on what the province should get. Now, that doesn't answer what happens at the school by school level. That's a provincial decision on how that allocation is made, which we need to fix. That's why I spoke about the school mapping exercise, to say which schools, which do we prioritize, and that's what the kind of work that we're focused on. The second part of your question is the critical part. And frankly, that is an area where we have huge challenges. You build a new laboratory, it gets broken into, it gets damaged. A new library, it gets broken into. What do we do? And that is something we've got money for, new development and for maintenance. We don't have money for that. That is the challenge. So we've got to look at how that gets dealt with. And that's a two-pronged strategy. One, and there's a secondary intervention to fix. The primary one is to make sure that communities own the schools, so that that doesn't happen in the first place. And we found that where communities are actively involved in the school, you don't have problems like that, about a laboratory or anything being broken. So I'm saying it's not an easy one for us to deal with. We're aware that that is one of our biggest challenges in the system.
Can I just follow up on that? Would it not be smarter to ensure that a school has sufficient security before you make these big investments in it?
Certainly, the security is there, for example, a fence, right, burglar guards. Those haven't proven to be. We found that some provinces have spent huge amounts of money on computer equipment, on libraries and so forth. And they fall victim to both theft and vandalism. It's not only theft. It's not only somebody taking a computer out to sell. Sometimes you go to school, it's destroyed. So you have all of those things. You have burglar guards, you have computers drilled down. The difficulty is to have human security in the schools. It's very expensive. Even if you have that, the person is actually the first, or it's not enough to have one person. So again, you go back to the community. So you don't have that threat in the first place. It's reducing the threat as opposed to reducing the deterrent. And you've got to find a balance for it. So I'm saying it's not an easy one. That is the big challenge we're facing in certain areas. But you go to other areas, and I've recently myself encountered a school where not only do they have facilities, they've got like a vegetable garden with the most luscious vegetables in the school. No one takes it. You know, people come up the weekend and watch it, but they won't take it. And that's where the school is part of community life. The equipment, everything stays. The school is used over weekend. It's very locked. You know, it's like a flimsy lock or something. The windows don't have burglar guards. But the school stays intact. And I think that's the intention that we're trying to achieve through the quality learning and teaching campaign. Also, a
culture of returning equipment. We find readers' library books very often in schools not returned. And that, you know, textbooks not returned. It causes a huge strain on our budget, and it's something we need to fix as well in the system. Then to Ms. Nda, sector-wide monitoring, what has been some of the problems? You put your finger on a very important issue, Ms. Nda, not only in education but throughout government, where we monitor, but it doesn't always work very well. And one of the main reasons, the other reason, one of the main reasons is we haven't had clearly defined targets that we measure. So it was always very loose. You know, did you distribute textbooks? Yes, we did. Now we say, let's calculate exactly what the percentage achievement is for learners, what percentage of textbooks, what textbooks, and let's put in the monitoring mechanisms to achieve that. So I think we're in a much better position now because of two reasons. One is we've got better targets, and two, with experience, we've developed greater capacity and institutionalization of monitoring and evaluation capacity to do that. So that's the what we're hoping is going to help us. Then the age of admission, this is a big story. We had changed the age of admission, not changed, there wasn't a law around about 97, 96. And then in 98, we introduced an age of admission of 10 and 7 to start grade 1. There was a court challenge after that, and what happened then, resulting from case law, is that the current policy is that the age of starting grade 1 is starting 7, but you can enroll your child starting 6 if you can prove that the child is ready. If the child is turning 7, you don't have to prove it. Therefore, for grade R, turning 6 is the age of enrollment, but the child can enroll 10 and 5. Now, a lot of research, I'm not an expert in this area, I've just consumed the research. A lot of research argues very strongly that it's not only about whether a child is academically ready. It's about whether a child is emotionally ready for schooling up to that age. And the agreement is turning 7 is the best age to start grade 1. And turning 6 is the earliest. I must say I've enrolled both my kids turning 7, despite the pressure from the neighbors to enroll in turning 6. Because it was based on that emotional thing. They were ready academically, but it was the emotional thing. So very often, wherever we go, people debate this matter. But many countries have gone this route of turning 7. There are bigger issues behind what you raise. Because, you know, and again, I'm coming to Ms. Gina's point here, which I want to emphasize and thank her for that question. And let me just put it in here, that you're absolutely right. This wasn't being interpreted to say there's a problem with the policy. When I say flaws, I mean around implementation. And it's minor implementation tweaking we're talking about. So again, for the record, let me emphasize, and I need to fix that wording because you're right, you're interpreting that. We're not talking about policy changes. We're talking about implementation issues here. So some of the things I'm talking about here relate to Ms. Ndar's point. If we say age of admission is whatever, we need to make sure that the curriculum is like very carefully articulated for that age of admission, including in grade R. Now, one of the policy gaps we have at the moment, which we want to fix, is that sometimes the grade 1, in the way schools teach the curriculum, is they assume all learners have been in grade R, whereas all learners haven't. For example, we picked up with some of our guides we're sending to schools, is that some teachers believe that they've got to start with that guide, even though the learners haven't been to grade R and they don't know how to hold a pencil. So we need to fix that, to tell teachers that in grade 1, not all your learners who come in know that to hold a pencil. So that's the kind of gap I'm talking about. But I'll speak further about the issues with Gina's right.
Can I just make a follow-up on that one? I think he is responding to my question in exactly the way I wanted to understand it. But I'm now wanting to check if a DG, for instance, you can use career reasons. For instance, I know that in the Army Navy, every time they are recruiting people who are interested to join the Army Navy, they will have age restrictions. And in most cases, it will be ages that would not be above 30. And assuming that your child is has already a career that is linked to the schooling, I mean the starting of the schooling, would that be accepted generally in the education system if that is used as a reason? Regardless, I'm trying now to say the environment, emotionally and otherwise, he is ready. but now that may not make your case to be stronger. Can they accept then the career on a long-term goal basis?
No, that I think that's an important one to look into. I actually haven't thought about that issue.
Maybe it's one of the issues that you need to raise with the Defence Force as opposed to basic education. Because really the issue is, do you push a child to go to school earlier so he can make certain timelines and time frames later on in his life, when in fact he or she is not ready? So what you'll find is the floundering in the middle somewhere there. And that's really the issue. But this is obviously, I mean, it's a huge area of debate and discussion. And even researchers can't agree,
they don't agree
on what is the appropriate age. Because, you know, I mean, it's stuff that you encounter all the time in education. Everybody learns differently, is different, has different needs. And unfortunately, we're stuck with a schooling system, and not just in this country, everywhere else, that is a mold. And people have to somehow fit into that mold. Now, when you're ready to fit into that mold is, you know, it depends and varies widely. But now, the reason I spoke was because I hope that members who have asked questions don't think that because I asked Mr. Lorimer and Ms. Mdart to ask follow-up questions that you're going to get the same opportunity. We're running out of time, and I'm sure that there are other people who want to ask questions who haven't had an opportunity. So I'm going to urge DJ as well, as much as we enjoy hearing you and your thoughts and stuff, can you just be brief in response? Because I'm sure people will come back as well to some of these issues.
Thank you. I want to just then focus on Ms. Gina's question, because I think it's important, because we don't want to be misunderstood here. We're not talking about serious flaws at the fundamental policy level, just to clarify. We're talking about implementation issues. For example, we've got a policy to attract teachers to rural areas. We've got an incentive payment. At the moment, it's not working because teachers who go to rural areas to get an incentive payment still travel from their homes. So they travel for 2 hours to get to the school, to get the incentive payment and come back. So we need to tighten that. In other words, they then need to be domiciled or resident in that rural area. I can think of others. For example, private schools and the way we monitor them. We found in certain provinces, the failing schools are actually these private schools which form very quickly. They're not being monitored. They're not being registered properly. There's a problem with policy and follow-up there. And it's been creating a huge problem of abuse of people. So again, there, it's something we've learned with time we need to fix up. So those are some of the issues I've been talking about. Then to be very brief, following the chair's injunction here, ENA linked to existing policies very much. It needs to be curriculum teacher development very strongly linked. In terms of school funding, Section 21, again, we've had a major review there. There has been a problem in the allocation of powers and provinces transferring money to Section 21 schools. We're working with provinces to fix that. But clearly, there's been some gaps. All in all, though, our evaluation, our research shows that it's working fairly well in terms of implementation there. The quintile system is a problem, but generally, the funding norms is working fairly well. You've raised the issue about rural teachers and the distribution. It continues to be a problem. What we're trying to look at now, Honourable Chair, is rural housing for teachers. It may be an additional incentive to solve this problem I've spoken about rural teachers living far away. Then a link between Foundations for Learning and Workbooks, very definitely. There is a link. They'll be developed together, and we will have explicit guidelines for teachers, and intervention to support teachers to implement the workbooks and Foundations for Learning. Mr. Khaniago, learner well-being was a comment, and then remedial intervention is something that's very much our desire. We're looking at how we do that in schools, and we're looking at how, through the comment you make, itinerant experts also trying to fulfill that function. But it's part of our inclusive education policy. Mr. Matubela, instill confidence. You put your finger on it. Confidence is best achieved if you actually succeed in influence. So we take that point completely. Stability in politics, yes, indeed. You say it needs to stand the test of time. That's exactly our approach to it. The other comment on how enforceable is the plan in provinces. I think that's an important question, and key to the plan is precisely to achieve that support. support working with and through provinces, improving accountability and enforceability. Up to now, we haven't had a plan for the sector. For the first time now, we've got common indicators for the whole sector. And you'll see from our plan and from international experience, that's the best way to achieve enforceability. Capacity building for SGB is definitely a challenge and something which very much is part of our agenda. The data system, let me just say there, it is a common system. Unit is a common system. What Mr. Mfoko is talking about is on-site verification of the information, and that's where we pick up discrepancies. And then, you know, about distribution of workbooks, Mr. Matubela raised, picked up an important issue there, where we make certain announcements and we distribute certain things, but it doesn't get from the district to the school. Mm-hmm. So a parallel system of monitoring is actually what we do. We also try to use the QLTC to support in that process. Honorable Chair, with your permission, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Mfoko to answer the questions raised by Ms. Mashwana around infrastructure.
Thank you, Chair. The composition of the Affidi Task Team, remember the representation at provincial level starts from the district. So a district that has a project will definitely be represented at a provincial level. There will be that kind of reporting from your district level to your province. So in a way, districts are not cut out from that structure. And I mentioned, maybe the honourable member didn't hear me, in the issue around what are we providing to schools, administration blocks are very key. Just to add, we in our suggestions through provinces, we realize that in most instances where schools do not have administration blocks, when teachers want to hold meetings, they take learners out of classrooms to hold meetings. So that is very critical, and in our norms and standards, it's very clear that schools must have administration blocks. The last question on whether every school will get water. The intention, look, it is a basic necessity that a school must have water. So the intention of this project is that at the end of this strategic planning period, all schools would have been provided with water and sanitation facilities and electricity.
Last one, sorry, onwards. Can I hand over to Mr. Masuwe for the grade 7 question asked by Ms. Mashwana?
Okay, let me deal with it. I think part of our approach is to ensure that with the district development plan, we understand that grade 7 oftentimes is in a primary school, and 8 and 9, which are still part of your GET, by and large, in high schools. The question has been, how do you ensure that you provide support to schools? Because at the end of the day, it is the type of support that you provide to the schools that then begins to help get information and support to teachers more appropriately. And part of what we're doing is to ensure that we link that and strengthen it at the level of the extent to which districts will be able to support schools. And the district development plan is very critical in that particular regard. Chair, if you also allow this, there's a question that also came back with respect to the annual national assessment. And I think there's also we also have to clarify the distinction between annual national assessment, which comes at the end of the year, to school-based assessment that must also happen as a build-up towards an annual. And I think in this particular context, it is what we do to strengthen both as a means of ensuring that our learners would be able to achieve the appropriate levels. And I think it is at those two levels that the system will always do. Yeah.
I think the issue was around what are the consequences arising from performance in the the national assessment process. So in other words, you may have your school-based assessment, which informs progression to the next grade and so on. But what are the consequences for the learner particularly when it comes to this issue, I think is the question. Because that informs what you were saying about what you don't want these assessments to do. And I think if you clarify that up front, I think you're going to deal with a lot of issues that may arise later on after implementation. I don't know if you want to speak to that issue.
Currently, Honourable Chair, the annual national assessment, which happens in the last term, counts as the fourth assessment, as combined with the school-based assessment.
So
it links to progression. Curriculum linked, it links to progression. But you're still raising an important issue which we need to be vigilant about, because of the four, it's the only externally set one.
Correct.
And it could become high stakes.
Yeah.
We could have grade three learners developing anxiety, and their parents and teachers. And we've got to be very careful about it. We don't want grade three learners to feel like the grade 12 learners feel. So we're vigilant to that issue. But in addition to it linking to the curriculum and progression, we'll also use it as a diagnosis of the school, where the teaching is happening, where the areas of weakness may be, and for the system. And that's not linked to the learner directly. And the learner won't answer to that. The teacher must answer to that. And the school principal must answer, and the district must answer to that latter part. But again, all in all, there are things that we've got to be very vigilant about the impact, unintended impact this may have on learners, and we're factoring that into the approach as well.
And is it still up for discussion as to when you're going to implement, when I say when, I mean in what quarter of the year you would want to begin these assessments? Because if they're going to be in the fourth quarter, you're not going to be able to obviate those pressures that you're talking about. I mean, that's just going to happen, whether we like it or not. We don't like it, but it's going to happen. But if you were to, for example, do it in the first quarter of the following year, in the fourth grade, let's say, as opposed to the third grade, that may have different consequences. I mean, is that still something that you'd be toying around with, or have you agreed that that's going to happen when it's going to happen?
Look, currently, Honourable Chairperson, we've implemented this already in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and we've been implementing it in grade 3, 6 already. Grade 9, we're piloting this year for the first time. And we've implemented it in the fourth quarter. We want to maintain that consistency in the system. The issue you're raising has come up because some people have said you got to assess learners after they finish grade 3, finish grade 6, and finish grade 9. So you do it at the beginning of the next year to give you a sense. There is also motivation to say do it in the fourth quarter. So at the moment, we want to try and maintain as far as possible the link between what was done before.
Okay.
And we'll review, of course, as time goes by on which is the best approach.
Okay. Let me just also say to you that in your response to Mr. Makubela, you spoke about stability in politics. I think you meant stability in policy. Some of us would like stability in politics, but I don't think the opposition would appreciate that. let me have Dr. Klopas-Lewis.
Short question. You mentioned that we dealt with the Sabbath that is comfortable with the president, and you also mentioned that it should be accurately defined, and some people are working extremely hard on these targets. Who are they? How do they do it? Is it a scientific exercise? Because it creates certain expectations. Then on the question of the question marks for physical science, you've mentioned that it was a paper that was too difficult. Was it the paper or was it the curriculum that was too difficult? Then when you dealt with the external assessment, you underlined the fact that it gives the teacher an indication of standards. But surely this should be dealt with during teacher training or really at university level. Do you agree with me? And you also said that parents should be informed about the results of these external assessment tests. But what about then the possible problem of parents insisting that the children should be able to attend certain schools with a better results? The competition then to get the learners or the children enrolled into certain schools, at certain schools. You've also mentioned the schools that protect their track record and specifically their pass rate, to the 100% pass rate, and you mentioned that they discourage certain learners not to attend those schools. It was also recently reported in the media that certain schools hold grade 11 learners back. in order to protect the pass rate. I would like your comments on that as well. And then Ms. Mdaz and Mr. Kanyaku's remarks regarding the age of admission. Your department has done away with school readiness tests. What is your stance on that, and what do you plan to do about school readiness tests in future? And the final question is, on the slide, I think it's slide 19, you refer to parents and the support in the home. Do you give parents any guidance in this regard? Thank you.
Add a few questions around the workbook, because I think one of the aspects we haven't really looked at in our deliberations has been that. You know, one of the issues that I have been very worried about, and let me preface this to say that I don't think you're going to get 100% buy-in, particularly when something new is launched, right? Us being human beings, and particularly teachers being teachers, as you pointed out, need stability and they need predictability and so on. But the one thing that comes up again and again in the submissions that we've received from particularly teachers, and particularly those experienced teachers, are issues around the curriculum. Now, from where I sit, and I am not a teacher, I've never been a teacher, and I probably couldn't make the grade to be a teacher, but it seems to me that each of the issues that people raise in the curriculum so far has been niggling me. But it is so niggling that it becomes big issues. So let's put it this way. A teacher is tasked with delivering X, and there's something in X that they just don't like. They don't understand why it's there, why, you know. What that does is it undermines confidence in that curriculum, and immediately you develop a negative attitude towards it. Now, that seems to me to be something that you want to avoid with regard to the workbooks. And the reason I'm raising this is it seems to me that with the curriculum development, we've been assured, for example, that a lot of work goes into developing the curriculum, a lot of expertise, a lot of benchmarking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, the question is not whether you get it right or wrong or whatever it is. The question is around getting buy-in, particularly from the people that you expect to deliver the curriculum. And the minute you don't have buy-in, complete buy-in from that sector, then what you have is an inbuilt situation where people start undermining the curriculum. Either they don't teach it well, either they don't communicate it well, they don't deliver it well. And it seems to me that that becomes the essence of what is essentially a successful or an unsuccessful subject curriculum. Now, when it comes to the workbooks, I can't tell you how many people have written in to say that I have been a foundation phase teacher for 37 years, 47 years, whatever. And this is how I feel about literacy and numeracy, and we must make sure that there's repetition and remedial happening in the class. We mustn't just offer the subject or whatever it is and then expect parents to continue the revising and instilling of that basic and foundational skill. Now, with the workbooks, as much as you say that there'll be experts that you'll be getting to design the content of it and so on, it seems to me that there'd be some merit in really looking at who it is that is designing the stuff. Whether that those particular individuals are practicing teachers, and then perhaps even have a separate phase where once you've got a booklet and before you publish it and before it's rolled out and so on, to actually have an exercise where, you know, in each province you give it to really experienced foundation phase teachers to say, look at these workbooks, let us have your comments. And you don't have to do it, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of teachers. But even if you were to have five in a province or something and go through that extra step, for practitioners, people who are in the classroom who are busy teaching currently, so that there is that sense of buy-in. And, you know, provinces can start selecting their own teachers and so on to represent their views and whatever. I really think that even if it takes you another 2 months, that that's going to be time well spent, because the time you're going to get to lose when it comes to actually delivering these workbooks and then the criticism that you're going to get on it and how it doesn't work in the classroom and how you expect them to sit with the workbooks plus teach plus, just in terms of how practical it is. I really think that you guys need to think about that aspect and maybe have this level of buy-in as well. Then let me come to the questions. The issue is, with the workbooks, I understand that we are going to give it to only certain quintile schools. Would the other schools be expected to purchase them? And would this be a standard requirement, in other words, workbooks and workbook assessments as a result, are these meant to be standardized, or are we only going to be delivering the workbooks to certain schools who are then expected to use them? That issue becomes a big problem if we get to the point where certain schools are, and then, you know, we get back to the whole debate about quintiles and the problems that we have with quintiles and so on. So I'm just I want to raise this question because I do think that the whole objective has been constantly that you have a uniform process and not just, you know, staggered process and so on. And what's your plan with regard to that? Anybody else have questions around workbooks? 1, 2, very quickly, Mr. Lorim. Okay, 1, 2, 3, very quickly.
Question about distribution of workbooks. Have tenders gone out? Is it going to be done by the provinces? Is the national department going to do it?
Okay.
I want to
ask a question. Just press the button.
This is very much an exercise in curriculum development. Are you going to pilot the books in certain schools in the first place, and are you going to train the teachers in the second place? And then also, at last year's final or last meeting, Ms. Chibeka referred to the plan to regarding mother tongue education for grades R to 6. Now, the books are going to be translated, but what about the teachers? Do we have enough teachers to train or to teach learners up to grade 6 in the mother tongue? No, we don't. What do you plan? What are the department's plans regarding teachers and the competencies when it comes to mother tongue?
Thanks, Chair. I've been covered by that question. That was my first question. But the last one, the President had spoken about this workbook, the workbooks to be part of this year, starting from this year. Is that already in inclusive of this year, or it will start at a later stage? Thank you.
I think on Mr. Lorimer's question, we would require a written report on the entire process and where you are and so on, right? But please go ahead and respond to whatever you can respond to.
Honourable Chair, I'll start with Ms. Dr. Klopas-Lawrence's questions, and then I'll come to the workbooks one, and Mr. Sue will add to that as well. The first question is on the targets and who's setting them. Is it a scientific process? It is. We've got technical people inside the department and some outside. We're using various data sets, testing the data, getting advice from some international people to ensure that we do two things. One is we quite comfortable with the accuracy of the data, and two, comfortable with the analysis. So it is very much a scientific exercise being conducted by statisticians and economists and so forth. Physical science, the question is it the paper or the curriculum? I think very insightful question. I think according to Uma Lucy and the experts, it's indeed both. Mr. Moswe may want to comment further on that, but we still, I don't want to presuppose the outcome of the discussion with Uma Lucy, because we're very careful not to appear as if we're trying to force Uma Lucy into any particular direction. We've got a meeting with them where we'll discuss this thing. We want them to maintain the custodians of standards, and we don't want it to appear as if we're trying to set that standard. So I don't want to say too much on that issue. Anna, give teachers an indicator of standards. Again, Dr. Klopas-Lawrence asked whether teacher development in universities need to do that. They do, and they indeed try to. And I've taught teacher development at universities, and very often you find it's only when you hit the classroom that you get a good grasp of it. That's the one issue. The other issue is that we've got a lot of challenges around teacher development in many schools that face the most serious challenges in the country. And that's where we think this is going to help to set those standards. Parental involvement and parents then insist on attending better schools. That will indeed happen. It's already happening. We already have a situation. The schools I spoke about that are emptying out is because parents are saying they want to take their kids to other schools. So that may happen, but the issue for us is that we want to hold schools accountable to make sure that parents stay in that school, hold the principal accountable and hold teachers accountable. If the school empties out, the principal and the parents and the teachers need to answer for that. So I think it will help us with accountability.
But it works both ways. We were at a school where the school was had turned around, but because of an historic perception on the part of the community that this was a bad school, people were still leaving that school. So, you know, in terms of updated information,
yes, right,
absolute to-the-minute kind of information, I think it's going to be a very useful tool for the community as well. Because once changes are made, both in terms of management and teaching staff and so on, you actually can turn the school around, regardless of resources or where it's located.
And Anna and Grade 12 results will help with that. It's updated. It's to say, look, the school has changed from last year, 2 years ago, to now. The other question from Dr. Klopas-Lawrence is around the gatekeeping, as we've come to call it, where some schools hold back grade 11 learners to protect their pass rate, some to preserve 100%, others just to keep it high. That is a problem which is receding now. It was a big problem around 2001, 2002. We're addressing it now, but it still continues to be a problem. So what we do now, we're tracking enrollment grade 9, 10, 11, and 12, and we're holding schools accountable. And tracking that, because the biggest dropout is not from grade 1 to grade 9. It happens post-grade 9, and that's because of this phenomenon. So we want to track that as well. Age of admission, we have stopped school readiness tests correctly, so for learners turning 7 want to enter grade 1. And that's because basic education is a constitutional imperative, whether a learner is school ready or not. So a school readiness test can be used to decide admission. It can be used in law to decide where the learner is and what support the learner needs. That it can be used for. For grade 6, for age 6 wanting to enter grade 1, we're saying there must be some demonstration. Not by an expert, you know, psychometric test or something like that. Somebody who can just say, look, this child can start school for emotional and other reasons, you know, academic reasons the child can. But certainly we're saying that from a constitutional point of view, what some schools have been doing is they do a school readiness test, the child is turning 7 and say the child can't start school. That's illegal. The child must be accommodated in school, and the school and the system must then work out how they deal with that child's education going forward. Even if that child can't go into that school, the MEC must find a place for that child to deal with that child's needs. And then parents and support guidance, very definitely, in terms of the workbooks and everything else, we will give guidance to parents, but I do take the point that we can't expect too much in terms of what parents do without giving guidance. In fact, with the workbooks, one of the things we've got is a parent guide that will help parents when kids get home with the workbooks to support their kids. Chair, the point you made about buy-in is absolutely important. You know, it's sometimes it counts for like 80-90% of policy implementation, and that will apply to the workbooks. Your question and Dr. Klopas-Lawrence's question, we will, as part of the design, bring in practitioners and experts in the development. Part of the plan is to pilot these workbooks in a real situation, in different kinds of
classroom settings. So it's not just, you know, schools that are functioning well. It will also give it to good practitioners to review, but we'll give it to the average practitioner to say, let's see what this practitioner does when they first see the workbook. What's their reaction to it? How do they understand its implementation? Does the teacher guide help them? And we'll observe their teacher, not to test the teacher, but simply to say, here's a generic teacher who's teaching in a rural area. What does this teacher do? So we'll do all of that in developing the workbooks. Because you're absolutely right. We don't want to put something in that hasn't been tested.
Get us a list, DG, once you do that, of the participating schools.
Yes.
Because what we will then do is we will actually then call them for hearings and give you a public platform. Because
okay.
You see, once people who are ordinary practitioners who did not participate realize that people just like
them
facing
good.
The
yes.
same issues
yes.
have gone through this process, it does add to the quality of the buy-in.
Okay. Mr. Lorimer's point, I think it would help us to provide it in writing as to how we distribute. Currently, there's a few options. We have a standing contract for distribution, so there's no need to go out on tender on that one. We want to avoid that tender process that we had at the beginning of the year. So it will either be through provinces, through that existing contract we've got where our books normally get distributed, but we haven't decided on which option yet. We'll provide in writing exactly which of those options will be pursued. I've answered Dr. Kloppel Lawrence's first question. On the mother tongue, I'll ask Mr. Masuwe to address that. Do we have teachers, you know, up to grade 6 who are able to do that? And then in Mr. Ndar's question, in terms of what the President said, initially when we went out on tender, the plan was to distribute the books at the beginning of this year. Because that tender showed us that there weren't any available provider who could develop that books in a credible manner to deliver it to schools that will make a difference, we did not go ahead with the development of the workbooks at that stage. As Mr. Masuwe has indicated, for now, we still plan to distribute it in the second half of this year after it's been piloted. But the bulk of the distribution will be for full implementation next year. So obviously, whatever we implement this year will not be for the full year. It will be for that remaining part. But that will give us important information. Now, Chair, can I just add a thing here? The advantage of doing this thing in-house is that as we get feedback, we can adjust the workbooks. You know, we don't have to go out on tender again and get the publisher to develop it. We have the capability in-house to adjust the workbooks based on feedback we receive here and here, and certain changes that need to be made. Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll hand over then to Mr. Masuwe with your permission on board.
Chair, there's a question also in relation to are we only targeting specific quintiles or would it be available to everybody else? In the initial stage, we had understood, and in the context of DG's comments, that there are those schools that would already have resources, but it's how you then support the under-resourced schools in the initial phase. But clearly, the whole intention is to provide for all other schools within the normal LTSM budget once this process has rolled over in outer year. But I think what is important in the context of workbook development is this whole issue of internal capacity, but then how then we build on those national catalogs as part of the other process that the Minister has also spoken to through the ministerial committees that are dealing with the NCS implementation review, because there was a particular recommendation in terms of how we should deal with LTSM generally, and it is in that context that all other schools would be provided for. Chair, the question on mother tongue, what we have decided to do was to ensure that in the current context with respect to workbooks, let me take one step back. We currently have the foundations for learning being implemented in all schools. There are lesson plans, there are assessment frameworks, all those are available in English. But the question is, how do you make sure that they then would become accessible in other languages that we offer in our schools and in the country? And that is why the process, alongside the process of development of workbooks in English, we also have to ensure, which would be aligned to the lesson plans for foundations for learning, how do we make sure that we then translate and version those, as we previously indicated, into other languages and therefore ensure that they are available in the support. clearly the question of do we have enough teachers that can teach mother tongue. As was indicated previously, that's a challenge that the system is addressing. And part of what the Funza Lushaka Bursary scheme was intended to do was to also begin to target those in that particular area as a means of ensuring that we capacitate the system in that particular regard. But clearly, as it relates to how we would move forward with workbook development, it's this whole question of how we ensure that we provide adequate support for teachers to be able to interact with the resources that we put into them. So that is the one matter. And I think the other matter we've taken I think comments that came from the chair with respect to how we get buy-in are very useful and would ensure that they are taken care of.
Well, in that written report, I think you need to give us more details and elaborate on exactly what the implementation plan looks like. So over and above the issue of the tender processes, delivery, and so on, I think the whole scenario and from now till whenever, when you talk about outer years, whatever those outer years are, how you expect to phase in this process of the workbooks and so on, just so that we have a clear picture of what has to happen when and by what time. Okay. Mr. Khanyapa, I know that you're burning to ask a question, but if you don't do it in 1 minute, then I'm going to rule you out.
Thank you very much.
I know this might be interpreted, differently from how I want to put it, but when we speak about the mother tongue as medium of instruction, sometimes I shiver. Some of you will agree with me. If you go to schools where they normally have, assemblies where a teacher reads from the Bible, and I'm just talking about those who do that. What I have observed, really, it could be 1 out of 10 teachers who will read the Bible in the mother tongue fluently, and you know this person is reading the Bible in his own language. But when they read in English, they are so fluent. So I always in my mind say, but how are these people going to do it? Because if you can't read in your own language, we talk about learners not being proficient in reading. I wonder whether you should not, I know teachers will not like it, but it is like that. They don't read fluently in their own language. They can read fluently in another language. So this is a problem. I don't know how they're going to teach kids in their own language, the language that they cannot really master very well. That's just a comment.
Well, it's more of a conundrum, it seems to me. And it kind of brings to mind what was said earlier about the school readiness assessments. My secret fear, and I'm sharing it with you today, is that I'm not sure that many of us would pass the school readiness. So those conundrums exist, Mr. Khanyahu. But look, these are issues that experts write about and so on. One of the issues I suspect gives rise to something like that would be the fact that as a written language, a lot of our official languages were never written languages. And so just like English, you wouldn't read it fluently from day one, even though you speak it fluently. It's a question. Reading is about practice and comes over time. I mean, I can say with some certainty, right up to about standard 7, standard 8, one read with difficulty in the sense that you exert some energy when you read. It's only thereafter, when you're a little more mature and so on, that reading becomes second nature. It goes down to how our brains and our cognitive development happens and whether reading is a primary skill or whether it's a technique that is learned much later are all questions that people more clever than me can answer, but certainly not more clever than you. So with that, let's wind up. I don't know if Lorimer, you have a last comment?
Quick question on accountability. You've indicated that your job might be on the line if targets aren't met. The minister is signing a performance agreement. Who's going to carry the can? What if they're delinquent MECs? Second part is just a general indication of what the department intends to do about teacher accountability, and can you refer in your answer to both rewards and sanctions?
Can you do that in like half a minute?
The answer is yes. The Minister's Performance Agreement, the President will assert accountability. That's cascaded to me, I will answer to the Minister, and it goes down the system, right to the teacher in the classroom. The question is, we must make sure that chain implements and asserts the accountability.
Okay. Well, that's certainly our job, or certainly part of our job, and clearly one of the things that we'll need to do in DG is to get regular updates from yourself as to the detail around this plan. I think I can sum up by saying that I think we like what we're hearing as a preliminary issue, but what certainly we'll need to follow is the detail around a lot of these matters, and specifically the targets, the more specific targets. While you've done it with the literacy and numeracy issues in very great detail, I think the detail around the other issues and the other major prongs of the plan would still be something that we would want you to think about and to inform us as and when that gets done. So members, just rest assured that this is just a preliminary take on the thinking of the department. And I always find it useful to have them come here, even though certain things are not finalized, because what that does is that they can go away, and in finalizing these plans, they take into consideration the concerns of the portfolio committee in some of these matters, which clearly would require a great deal of work and consultation and effort going forward. So we do want to thank you, all of you, for your submissions, and we hope that you found the session fruitful, and we will as I say, DG, with your advice going forward, we will then schedule further sessions of this nature where you can come with more detail once your plans have elaborated. Okay, members, remember next week we are having a meeting on Tuesday, but that we are also going to start the public hearing, or the oral hearing segment of the public hearing, on Wednesday. With that, let me bid you good reading, happy reading. Don't swear too much when you see the volume of stuff that you need to read. But I'm sure you'll find them very, very interesting, and whether you agree with some of those views or not, they certainly have been well-motivated and make for stimulating thinking and so on. So we'll see you next week. Do we have venues yet? Okay. You'll be informed of the venues, and it will be in the regular schedule, the parliamentary order paper and so on. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, Makuben.
I'll send those photos on the
Facebook. His wife is going to I should have just turned off my computer.